administration doesn't care. In fact, cares too little about dictatorships in Africa and Asia and elsewhere. We are in the Middle East for oil, and the more we get out of oil, the more we'll finally have security in the United States. So check that energy bill. It's mostly a good thing. Tomorrow, 11 a.m., a debate on gun control. Now, this is Mark Levine signing off.
This is the Quality News Network. The Dow Jones took a nosedive today on news that the federal government cut a key interest rate by 0.25 percentage point to 4.25%. It's the third cut rate. In 3 months, the prime lending rate is down to 7.25%, the lowest level in 2 years. We'll have the numbers coming up in our business segment. A telephone hotline designed to help over a million subprime borrowers received a record 45,000 calls in 3 days following the president's plan to freeze interest rates on certain subprime loans before scheduled jumps in monthly payments. At least 50 people are dead following two truck bombs that exploded in Algiers today. As many as 177 people were wounded. The UN offices were heavily damaged in the attack. The North African branch of Al-Qaeda claimed responsibility for the bombing. The director of the CIA testified in a congressional hearing today that top levels of the U.S. government approved the waterboarding of a member of Al-Qaeda. A congressional hearing was launched following the destruction of videotapes of terror suspect interrogations. President Bush is calling on Iran to explain why its government had a secretive nuclear weapons program. Bush is pressuring Iran following last week's announcement by the National Intelligence Estimate that Iran had stopped its nuclear weapons program in 2003. Political powers from around the world will be participating in a conference call today to discuss the final text of a third UN resolution imposing sanctions against Iran. A vote on the matter is due next week. Talks between Israeli and Palestinian leaders start tomorrow, the first formal peace negotiation in 7 years. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert has pledged strong support for the establishment of an independent Palestinian state. In Baghdad this morning, a car bomb exploded outside the homes of two important Iraqi officials, including the country's former prime minister. Two policemen were killed, 13 were wounded. An investigation into the shooter who killed four people at a church and missionary training center in Colorado revealed that Matthew Murray shot himself in the head. Murray was shot multiple times by a security officer before he turned the gun on himself. You're listening to the Quality News Network.
You know you can depend on QNN for honest news. Now we want you to know about an honest source of information on one of the country's most desirable vacation destinations, Carmel by the Sea on California's beautiful Central Coast. That source is the best address in Carmel, carmel.com. Just a few simple clicks and you're visiting a website that mirrors all that Carmel stands for: quality, character, tradition, beauty, the great outdoors by the sea, cultural heritage, and the best shopping, charming inns, superb dining, world-class art, music, and theater, a cornucopia of delights. So when you're planning your next getaway, go to the best address in Carmel, carmel.com, for tips on everything Carmel. Then put that information to good use by visiting Carmel by the Sea for an unforgettable getaway. Carmel.com.
The federal government announced today that retailers will begin selling equipment enabling owners of analog TVs to watch programming after the 2009 nationwide switch to digital broadcasting. Well, despite a fast start last month, holiday sales at some of the nation's largest retailers have dropped significantly. A report by the International Council of Shopping Centers says the results jeopardize an already weak holiday sales period. Japanese drug maker Eisai will pay $3.9 billion to acquire U.S. biopharmaceutical firm MGI Pharma. It's the largest overseas acquisition ever by a Japanese drug company. Swiss pharmaceutical giant Novartis says it's paring away mid-management jobs in a cost-cutting effort aimed at improving its competitiveness against rivals producing generic drugs. Gold is currently trading up $3.60 at $817 an ounce. Light sweet crude oil is trading up $2.16 at $90 a barrel. And on Wall Street at the close today, the Dow Jones was down 294 points. At 13,432, the NASDAQ was down 67 points at 2,652, and the S&P 500 was down 38 points. We have more news on our website at qualitynewsnetwork.com. I'm Claudia Eisman.
Okay, Tokyo, South America.
Now, Head On with Bob Kincaid. Head On is brought to you every night by the West Virginia District Council of Carpenters and Millwrights. Union Carpenters and Millwrights, they're building the American dream. Free speech isn't free if you don't use it, so call Bob now at 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Now, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. Great to be with you this evening. About 6.5 minutes, coming up on 7 minutes past the hour. And it is Tuesday here on Head On. I am Magic 8-Ball Bob Kincaid. What do I mean by that? Well, we'll get to that in a minute. We'll get to a lot of things this evening. We'll get to your phone calls. We may or may not have a rather in-depth discussion about the status of the attempt at a recovery on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. And... well, okay, let's get this part over with. Last night, you know, it feels so funny to sit here and just casually on a given night tell you what's going to happen next and then watch it happen. Now that sounds terribly egomaniacal on my part, and I apologize if it strikes you as wrong or misguided. But it happens from time to time. For instance, last night on the program, right here, I'm going to be irritated all night long because the computer that does our streaming has a restart now button. It's just loaded some updates from Microsoft, and it's jumping up and down like a little Jack Russell Terrier on acid, begging me to restart the machine, and I keep telling it, no, no, bad PC, bad. But that still doesn't stop it from making the attempt. So periodically I'll be distracted when that little thing hops up and tells me, oh, Jesus, I want to restart, you know. No, but last night on the program, we were talking toward the end of it, the end of the program, that is, about, you know, the horrible, horrible shootings in Colorado Springs Sunday. Two teenage girls, their 51-year-old father, the two girls shot and killed by I hate to use journalism cliches, but a madman. And I said something. And, you know, because we're not persnickety about our archives and we put them out there for anyone to hear who wants them, to listen to podcast, whatever, you know, you have to pay boku dollars to actually be able to catch Flush Flemball in his lies, and maybe that's, you know, maybe that's why you have to pay. On our end, however, we don't hide from what we say, right, wrong, or indifferent. And being liberals and progressives, we're not afraid to apologize when we screw up. This isn't a screw-up. I said this last night, about 20 minutes before the program ended. This will be used as a sympathy. It will be dragged out like a little red wagon to support the thesis that Christians in America are under attack. There you have it. I said it, and, you know, I say it there. I say it here, it comes out there, or something like that. A blog called The Carpetbagger Report, with which some of you are familiar, reporting today. On Sunday, this is direct from the blog post. On Sunday, in a gruesome tragedy, 24-year-old Matthew Murray killed two people at a Christian missionary center in Arvada, Colorado, and then killed two others at a Colorado Springs megachurch later that day. Murray apparently intended to kill others before a church security guard shot and killed him Sunday afternoon. There have been some developments in that story. Oh, Gesundheit me. There have been some developments in that story. We'll hit those in a second. But pursuant to what I said, lo and behold, less than 24 hours after I said it, along comes Tony Norman Perkins. Yes, Mother Bates. He's the head of the extremist group Family Research Council. You know, these people who think that marriage is the union of one man and one woman, and that a human being is the union of one sperm and one egg. He came along and couldn't resist, just as I predicted, prostituting the corpses of two dead teenage girls to advance his own agenda. Under a headline that read, "An Assault on Faith," Perkins told supporters in a weekly email newsletter, quote, "It is hard not to draw a line between the hostility that is being fomented in our culture from some in the secular media toward Christians and evangelicals in particular and the acts of violence that took place in Colorado yesterday." What a sick, sick bastard Tony Perkins is. Former insurance hustler, Tony Perkins, promoted to doing the religion hustle as part of an organization that is a front group for James Dobson. You remember the Family Research Council. This is the gang of goons who put on Sunday, Justice Sunday, in their attempt to get more reactionary freaks on the federal bench, all the way from the Supreme Court to the lowest federal magistracy. That's right. He blamed the shootings in Arvada and at the New Life megachurch on seculars. Secular media. What did I tell you? Isn't that just a little bit nuts? I thought it was a guy with a gun. I didn't see any liberal media out there squeezing the trigger. The way it is with these religion industry goons, they never eat their words, they never apologize, they never back down. They wait for you to back down because that's the way it is with a bully. But you might find it interesting to know, if you don't already, that in fact it wasn't, no, it wasn't some wild-eyed liberal or some homicidal atheist who did the evil deed yesterday in Colorado, or Sunday in Colorado. Nope. It was Matthew Murray. a young man, incredibly troubled, one of those homeschooled kids who came from a Pentecostal household and a Pentecostal upbringing. I think I've referenced this track a couple of times. Reminds me of the late, great Bill Hicks. I'd rather be raised by the Satanists down the street, the ones with the good albums. But Tony Perkins won't tell his mouth-breathing, knuckle-dragging faithful that, in fact, it was one of their own whose religious insanity got to the point that it bounced around the inside of his skull like some sort of Atari Pong game gone horribly, horribly haywire. No, no, he won't tell them that. He won't tell them that Matthew Murray was a part of that very Youth with a Mission program that he shot up. He won't tell them that he was denied, Matthew Murray was denied, a mission trip to Bosnia, you know, to take fundamentalist Christianity to the heathen Bosnians, because he was too mentally incapable of withstanding the trip. Yeah, he went to Youth with a Mission and learned how to missionize and whatnot, and even back then was spooking the people there because he was talking about what the voices in his head were saying to do. That's all right, son. That's just Jesus talking to you. You pray to him, why wouldn't you expect him to talk back? Yeah, but he's telling me to shoot everybody. Oh, well, that's a demon. You're possessed, son. But that's okay. You know, there's nothing magic in predicting this kind of behavior from the right-wing religion industry. It just takes a little bit of common sense. Just takes a full understanding of how manifestly evil the religion industry is. How thoroughly they can sicken a human being's mind. It turns out that he posted what he was going to do directly quoting the Columbine shooters. He posted what he was going to do on a website bulletin board called the Association of Former Pentecostals. It was a website designed to help people trying to recover from the sickness of fundamentalist religion. He'd been getting kind of creepy on that message board for about 6 months when he finally went off. They didn't throw him off the board because they felt like he needed a place to vent, and that maybe by venting he would be less likely to do harm. Oh, and by the way, the armed security guard who was credited with having saved hundreds of lives at New Life Megachurch, she didn't kill him. He killed himself. That's what the coroner's ruled. He has ruled a suicide. The death of Matthew Murray has been ruled a suicide, the El Paso County Coroner's Office said in a statement earlier today. I guess the security guard whose hand was guided by God, her aim was a little bit off. But he got away far enough to end his own life. Fascinating. Sick. Twisted. Brady Boyd, Brother Brady Boyd, senior pastor of New Life Church, told reporters Tuesday he and his church had already forgiven Murray. Well, even though he's still angry about what happened. But being angry and being unforgiven are two different things. I forgave him immediately. I can't imagine what caused him to do that. I'm sad for his parents for having to bury a young son. But forgiving him was an immediate response of our heart. And the congregation will hold regular services this Sunday. They can't even be bothered to set aside one Sunday for two pathetic dead teenage girls. Well, it turns out what Murray said on the website gives him an idea of where he was coming from. Quote, "I'm coming for everyone soon, and I will be armed to the teeth." He used the ampersand and the percent sign and the dollar sign because he was fundamentalist raised, and even though he was going to murder a bunch of people, he was not going to swear. "I'm coming for everyone soon, and I will be armed to the teeth, and I will shoot to kill." He titled it, he titled his post, "You Christians Brought This on Yourselves." Now, see, it's easy. We're just going to write him down as a crazy guy. He was just insane. And nobody's going to ask why, except for maybe some guy who's going to say that he should have had a better fruit smoothie. Maybe it wasn't drugs. Maybe it was the oldest organic mind twister of them all. Religion. Because, you see, it's not just him, it's anybody. It can happen anywhere, anytime, because we live in a culture where guns are readily available, and even more readily available is religion, organized religion, prepared as it always has been throughout all of human endeavor to make locked, cocked killing machines of its adherents at the drop of a hat. Sometimes, just like a regular firearm, sometimes they go off with unintended consequences. That would appear to be the case here. "You Christians brought this on yourselves." How sad and misguided he was, because, you see, after all, it's worth noting that there's not a single Christian in New Life Megachurch. Not one. There are a lot of people there who talk about Jesus and hang on to misunderstood, mistranslated, misapplied, outdated Old Testament texts. They threw their pastor out because he was so thoroughly closeted that he couldn't love the people he wanted to love, and instead had to sneak around hiring male prostitutes and rot his brain with methamphetamine in order to feel something approaching normal. And thus it happens. And thus it is that Tony Perkins, despite the fact that it was a fundamentalist who killed other fundamentalists, Tony Perkins blames what? The secular media. It is hard not to draw a line between the hostility that is being fomented in our culture from some in the secular media toward Christians and evangelicals in particular, and the acts of violence that took place in Colorado yesterday. That's read, if you, you know, I've read that three or four times today, and it keeps kind of bouncing back to me like a bad email. It is hard not to draw a line between the hostility that is being fomented. Grandmother Kincaid, let's diagram this sentence. It is hard. Let's take out that knot. It is hard to draw a line between the hostility and the acts of violence. It is hard to draw a line between the two, separating the two. Okay, let's put the knot back. It is hard not to draw a line between the hostility and the acts of violence. So he's saying that he would naturally assume that the hostility and the acts of violence are there, and that he's struggling not to. Rick Goodner, horn psychologist. Rick Goodner, horn psychologist. Emergency phone, please. He says it's hard not to draw a line between the hostility and the acts of violence. Well, I guess he's right. Or is he? I don't think I understand anymore. For me, it's hard to draw a line. It's hard to say that what this young fundamentalist, twisted, warped human being did, it's hard for me to say that that's a function of secular media. I think it's much more likely that when he writes a message saying, you know, you Christians have this coming, or you Christians brought this upon yourselves, I'm guessing that's a function of what he has personally experienced and has gone around and around and around and up and down and through and back and forth and sideways and upwards and downwards, in and amongst the ventricles and the lobes of his rotting homicidal brain. It's hard for me to draw a line between that and his acts. His acts are his own. Now, accomplices to this murder are the ease with which we can get firearms and the extent to which religion can make otherwise, you know, who knows what he could have been in his life. But religion twisted him. It took him like a piece of hot wire and twisted him until he broke. But that's okay. This is how fundamentalists are. After the, again, this from the blog over at the Carpetbagger Report, thecarpetbaggerreport.com. He notes, the author notes that after the Columbine tragedy, then House Majority Leader and indicted Texas politician Tom Huff the Bug Spray DeLay, a Republican, of course, said from the floor of the House of Representatives, and I quote, "Our school systems teach the cheering that they are nothing but glorified apes who are evolutionized out of some primordial soup. Young people learn modern biology, which in turn makes them feel insignificant, which in turn leads to violence." Wow. You know, I want medication after I read something like that. I want medication and a shower. But there's nothing new. There's Ken Ham. Ken Ham, the Australian emigre who founded the Creationist Museum where Adam and Eve sit having a picnic basket lunch under the shadow of a Tyrannosaurus Rex. Less than 24 hours after the massacre at Virginia Tech, he said, "We live in an era when public high schools and colleges have all but banned God from science classes. In these classrooms, students are taught that the whole universe, including plants and animals and humans, arose by natural processes. Naturalism, in essence atheism, has become the religion of the day and has become the foundation of the education system and Western culture as a whole. The more such a philosophy permeates the culture, the more we would expect to see a sense of purposelessness and hopelessness that pervades people's thinking. In fact, the more a culture allows the killing of the unborn, the more we will see people treating life in general as cheap." Really? Really, Ken? A million dead Iraqi civilians, and it's all because a woman in busted knuckle can actually go and deal with an unwanted pregnancy at a time in her life when she might not choose to be pregnant. really can. Funny, Mr. Ham, I thought that we were treating life as being cheap because it turned out to be very profitable for the Halliburton Corporation. Oh, I got a Halliburton KBR story for you later this evening, too. No, it's biology. It's teaching people what the origins of humanity are that make people want to just go absolutely bananas. Oh, see, there's that ape reference. And shoot up churches and missionary centers and shopping malls and high schools and, you know, the commons areas of military-based universities in southwestern Virginia. Yeah, it's the secular humanists. Secular humanists are going to get your Bible. I don't know what we're going to do. So, you know, no surprise, no crystal ball, no magic eight ball, no shaking, answer hazy, ask again later. No. The answer is never hazy, and you never have to ask again later when you're dealing with a member of the fundamentalist religion industry in this country. Because they are and will always be. They are and will always be actively engaged in fraud and money grubbing and hustling, and they do not give a tinker's damn who gets killed or slaughtered in the process. But don't, you know, again, the religion industry doesn't have to worry, because you're only going to hear that here. You might hear it from our good friend Mike Malloy. You might hear Hartman talk about it a little bit. But you're not going to hear it in very many other places. So the religion industry knows it's safe and knows that no one will call it on its evil. Especially since Tony
Norman,
yes, Mother Bates, Perkins, has sort of inoculated himself against it, because anybody who points out the fact that this kid was a fundy, you're persecuting us because we're religious, whoa! Screw him. Hope he gets hit by a bus. Let's go to the phones. Hey, who've I got?
This is Alan.
Well, hey, Alan, how are you?
I'm in Virginia.
Great.
Weather's pretty nice, I think.
It was 70... Alan, it was 75 degrees here today.
Wow. I think it's probably about 40 degrees here right now.
Well, it was very, very nice. What moved you to call this evening?
Oh, I was listening to you. I grew up, spent a lot of my youth around fundamentalists, and I noticed how a lot of them go to these homeschooling things.
Mm-hmm.
I figured that they're real people like kids like that are secluded from society. I think that's not a good thing.
No, it's not, and that's why we won't have anything to do with it here. Frankly, Alan, my wife and I are both fairly intelligent, fairly well-schooled people. We could take our kids out of the public school system and sit here and teach them all they needed to know to pass the standardized tests that they get every year, but they would miss out on something in the long run. There's a lot of negativity in the public schools, but they would miss out on actually learning to deal with other human beings. And frankly, that's as valuable a lesson as any human being can have in this world, isn't it?
I didn't catch that last part.
Well, no worries. But you're right. When you take a kid out of that environment, away from the need to the ability to interact and learn social skills, you wind up with this Murray kid.
Yeah, I know. It just doesn't seem right for kids to be secluded all their lives like that. They need to be out and about with other kids, and, you know, and other religions and other thoughts, whatever. It doesn't seem right.
Well, it isn't, because the first rule is everybody here has to get along.
Yeah.
And if you don't try to get along, then you wind up with this Murray kid.
Yeah. I guess the Christians who raise these fundamentalists, they They want this, I think you call it monolithic society, where everybody thinks the same. It's not going to happen.
No. At least, it can. And if you catch them by themselves, Alan, they fervently pray that they have the ability to do so. And given the opportunity to create that monolith society, they would gladly accomplish it at the point of a sword or at the muzzle of a gun.
Yeah, like the Romans did to our ancestors in Eastern Europe.
Exactly.
Yeah. Also, I noticed that when my sister went to a fundamentalist church, she went through her fundamentalist stage, I guess like the late 90s, early 2000s. I'm glad she got out of it, but I remember that when she was in this, she mentioned that they had Christian psychiatrists at these big mega churches that they suggest people to go to who have problems, which I would think some of those psychiatrists probably make the situation worse for a person with disability.
Alan, it's interesting you would mention that, because they do make the situation worse. It was not this past Friday's, but the Friday before that edition of the Horn Section. Rick Goodner was on, and I asked him pointedly about some of these issues, and he said, I only get these people when they've been broken beyond all recognition and the damage has already been done by the pastoral counseling and the in-church advice, and then we have to start trying to rebuild.
Yeah, I listened to Rick Goodner one time, and I thought he was really interesting. Does he have a show on their network?
Yeah, he runs on the weekends. It's called Rick's Place.
Okay, I catch that sometime.
Yeah, it starts... its first run is at midnight on Saturday night, midnight Eastern time, and then it rolls in rotation with the Sourds Report and Night Sounds with Billy Shears all through Sunday, wee hours of the morning, Sunday day, Sunday night, and into Monday. So if you just tune in on a Sunday, odds are if you stick with it, you'll catch Rick.
Okay.
You'll also hear the Sourds Report, which is awesome. Those young guys down there at Marshall are just blowing me away. Of course, you know, Night Sounds with Billy Shears is just a wonderful way to kick back and relax and, you know, sort of, as he says, you know, put it all aside for a while.
Okay. Well, thanks for taking my call. I'm still stressed over last night. I was driving this big truck around New Jersey area, pretty close to the Holland Tunnel, and I almost drove through that thing. That would have been a big mess, but...
Oh, mercy.
I made it through.
Oh.
Well, it gets to be pretty stressful driving these trucks sometimes.
Oh, I know. I don't know how you do it, Alan. I don't know how you do it. And as far as I'm concerned, I'm pretty sure that the over-the-road truck drivers in this country are not paid nearly enough. Yeah, I don't know what you make, but whatever it is, you need a raise.
Oh, yeah. Thanks. I believe it, too. Well, thank you. I'll be listening.
All right. You take care, Alan. Good to hear from you, and stay out of the tunnels, okay?
Okay, thanks.
Bye now. Oh, that would have just been kind of creepy, wouldn't it? Poor Alan. So I guess I'll let the... that's enough of that. That's enough of Matthew Murray. And, you know, we'll put it aside until we have to talk about the next murderer. The next person who takes advantage of a really piece of bad... Of all the good draftsmanship that went into the United States Constitution, the single worst piece of drafting has got to be the Second Amendment. As our good friend Mark Levine, noted congressional lawyer and scholar of the Constitution, has pointed out, the Second Amendment is the only amendment that has a preamble. And that preamble is the single most ignored piece of writing in all of American political draftsmanship. A well-regulated militia being necessary, yada, 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 yada. Just, yeah, forget it. Ignore it. It doesn't matter. The only part that matters in the Second Amendment is that part about arming bears. Jesus. So we'll let that slide. Interesting story developing from a report over at the Center for American Progress. We'll talk about that in a few. We'll also take... God, I got to stop. But we... I feel like Queen Victoria when I say we. But I'm still used to the idea of this being something that Agnes and I do together. And even though she's not back here producing, it's a we effort. Of course, the whole network is a we effort. Whether it's the hosts, the moderators, in the chat room, the news ninjas, it's all a we effort. Because it's like that line from Henry V, you know, we few, we happy few. I'd like for us we few, we happy few to be a happy lot more. And eventually we will be. But for now there's just a couple of, you know, a few tens of thousands of Americans tuning into these programs every day. And that can't begin to compare with the demographics of the millions upon millions upon millions upon millions of Americans who tune in faithfully to see whether or not the star of an old cop show can dance, or to see whether some kid from Birmingham can warble out a tune. We can't begin to compare with that. But we do what we can, don't we? We do indeed. Our good friend Marty writes in and says, perhaps these shooting incidents are also the harbinger of one of two things. One, to get people frightened into calling for more police state-style anti-terror policies, administered no doubt by a private corporation like Blackwater, or two, for the National Rifle Association to gather lots of cash to call for further loosening of gun laws so that we turn the U.S. back into the wild, wild west, with the twist being that everyone is concealing their weapons. Remember, in a few areas, not only are you permitted to carry a concealed weapon, but you are allowed to use deadly force anytime you feel threatened. Yeah, that's what do they call Disney World? The happiest place on earth? Well, what the state that surrounds Disney World is the most well-armed, nervous place on earth. Florida has one of those stand and blaze laws. P.S. Did you know that you sounded like you actually have sympathy for a hypocrite like Ted Haggard? Perish the thought. I do have sympathy for anyone who is driven to do bizarre, twisted, miserable things by virtue of the bizarre, miserable, twisted things that they allow to run their lives. Get free. You know, it's what my old buddy Chops all said all the time. Free your head, your ass will follow. And I believe that. So, well, I don't know where Ted Haggard is or what Ted Haggard's doing now. I'm guessing he's pretty miserable. He has to be, because he's still in the closet. One of many closets that exist here in America, as we've established both on Peter's program, this program, and others. Lots of closets in America. There's closets, you know, well, you know, what's the old saying? Protestants don't recognize the supremacy of the Pope. Catholics don't recognize the supremacy of the Eastern Orthodox Patriarch. And Southern Baptists don't recognize each other at the liquor store. Lots of closets. And I feel sorry for just about anybody who lives in one. Because it's not so bad out here among the normal, among people who are willing to live and be whom they are, who refuse and reject a hypocritical lifestyle, who refuse and reject to do evil in their lives. Not a bad place at all. And, you know, I did want to mention something to you, just because of the irony of it. I have an irony detector that just, it's got a hair trigger on it. This Murray kid who did these things in Colorado, was homeschooled, of course. Someone else, well, there's lots of homeschooled kids. So I got, you know, I'm always telling you about these right-wing interview pitches that I'm receiving. And one of them, the subject line a couple of days ago said, Heisman Trophy winner Tim Tebow was homeschooled, as if there was some connection between Tim Tebow's ability to play football and the fact that he was homeschooled. But somehow I doubt that I'll see an interview pitch that says, Colorado church shooter Matthew Murray was homeschooled. Freaks. Now, there's a lot of interesting stuff to hit this evening. And like I said, your phone calls are always welcome. You know the number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. If you've got your own unlimited long-distance plan, you can save us, as Peter says, a nickel or a buck by calling 304-658-5453. And just a quick update. Interesting. And look, John Fox kind of called me on it later in the evening. He said, Bob, I'm beginning to worry about your sanity. You're paying way too much attention to this Mike Huckabee character. And I had to explain that, you know, because the primary system doesn't begin in any sort of urbanized civilization, but instead begins in New Hampshire and Iowa and South Carolina and places like that, that we have to worry about freaks like Huckabee because that's where all the momentum gets built. You know, if you can make it in Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina, the skids get greased for the rest of your candidacy. Mike Huckabee would never have a chance in a California or a Washington or an Oregon if they had the early primaries. He wouldn't have a chance in Michigan or Wisconsin or Minnesota or, God knows, Illinois, Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York, Jersey, Massachusetts. But he's got a chance in the states where fundamentalism plays big, just like Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina. And so, yeah, we do have to pay attention to him. And it turns out, one, and it's one of those why won't they sort of moments, Mother Jones Magazine, if you ever get around, if you ever read it, it's a wonderful magazine, they've made a formal request for the sermons of Reverend Mack over the 12 years in which he was a pastor, starting at the age of 25, including his primacy over the entire Baptist congregation of Arkansas, some 490,000 strong. And the Mother Jones was told, we can't send you any of Brother Mike's sermons. Dog ate them. Can't find them. There aren't any audio recordings. Never mind the fact that this young man interned under James Robison and set up his own radio and TV religious broadcasting outfit. Can't find a single blessed tape. They're gone. They just don't exist. We can't find them. But we don't know what that dog ate them. No kidding. And so as a consequence, it's going to be a little harder to point out to America what a right-wing extremist this fool is. Now, he has been quoted on a few instances on some topics that might be of interest to voters. In 1997, he was asked a question during a call-in show about capital punishment. Wrap your head around this one, brothers and sisters. With regard to capital punishment, you know, killing in the name of the state. Reverend Mack said, interestingly enough, if there was ever an occasion for someone to have argued against the death penalty, I think Jesus could have done so on the cross and said, this is an unjust punishment and I deserve clemency. In other words, if Jesus didn't say anything about it, it's okay. The only problem with that, Brother Mike, is that Jesus didn't say anything about being homosexual, and you've still got a problem with that, even though he was completely silent on it. Never mind the fact that that entire answer is just crazier than a sprayed roach. I mean, more insane than a run-over dog. Here's a guy with nails through his flesh, running between the two bones, what is it, the radius and the ulna, of his arm, on either side, both arms. He's nailed in at the bottom. He's naked as the day he was born. He's had the hide flayed off his back. He's got a crown of cactus thorns jammed into his head, and he is hanging from a cross tie. Now, I realize that Reverend Mike thinks he was God on earth, but it's a bit much to expect dissertation on the wrongs of capital punishment when you are literally dying. He didn't say a whole lot of anything up there. And contrary to what Reverend Mike probably thinks, that sign over his head, INRI, Jesus Nazarenus Rex Judaicum, no, Brother Mike, that didn't stand for I'm nailed right in. But apparently that's what Brother Mike thinks, because he didn't find it in himself to say, what is it he was supposed to have said? This is an unjust punishment and I deserve clemency? That's like earlier when Brother Mike referred to the boy with the loaves and the fishes who fed the 5,000. Wasn't a boy with the loaves and the fishes, you dummy. It was your God. How about that? He's on such good terms with the Almighty that he can call him boy. Gotta wonder who else Brother Mike calls boy, coming as he does from Arkansas. Oh, yeah, this guy's patently insane. Not just a little bit, but a whole bunch. Can't get hold of his sermons, but we get a pretty good idea what would be in them, because when he was governor of Arkansas, the Arkansas legislature passed a law that would have assisted storm victims. They'd had a bunch of tornadoes and so forth blow through. And the bill referred to the damage caused by the tornadoes and floods as, quote, acts of God. Huckabee refused to sign the bill because he said it would, quote, be violating my own conscience, because the bill would have equated a destructive and deadly force as an act of God. I'm not kidding. I'm really, really not kidding. I really, really wish I was. But it goes on and it goes on and it goes on. Ladies, Brother Mike has some advice for you, too. In August of 1998, Huckabee was one of 131 people who signed on to a full-page ad in the USA Today that said, quote, I affirm the statement on the family issued by the 1998 Southern Baptist Convention. Well, I guess that's well and good until you realize what was in it. That 1998 statement said, quote, a wife is to submit herself graciously to the servant leadership of her husband, even as the church willingly submits to the headship of Christ. You got that, ladies? Do you know anybody out there that's even thinking about voting for Mike Huckabee? Would they happen to be female? Would you do me a favor and share with him what he thinks of women, that you all haven't the common sense that God gave a stumped gosling, and your only function is in life is to submit graciously to your husband? Does that mean when the drunken bastard backhands her that she's supposed to say, "Thank you, sir, may I have another?" I don't, my God. A couple of minutes left before the news. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to the program.
Yeah.
Hey.
Somebody would like, I saw this on the, on a call going across the TV this morning. Hubby was watching. Somebody else wants to talk to dear old Mike.
God?
Ryan White's mother.
Oh. What did he do? What did he do to Ryan White? As if I can't guess.
He said all AIDS victims should be, I think the word used was segregated.
Quarantined.
Quarantined, basically, yeah.
Yeah.
So Brian White's mother wants to talk to him. And she wants to know, where do you get off?
It's a fair question. Of course, he says, I wouldn't say it that way now.
Yeah, sure he would if he thought he could get away with it.
And that is the real tipping point, isn't it?
Yep.
What can they get away with?
Yeah, but then, of course, Ryan White's mother is one of those women who is supposed to submit.
Yeah. How do you feel about submitting there, Susan?
Right up to side of head. You're talking to a woman who informed her husband on her wedding night, "Don't ever hit me in anger because you will have to sleep sometime, and that's when you're going to find a knife between your ribs."
Oh, it must have been a charming night.
I have strong views on physical force.
Well, so do I. But, you know, I mean, if you're supposed to submit to your husband, I guess if he decides to give you a whomping, it's a whomping you've got coming, isn't it?
No. It's a whomping he's going to get mad.
There are people this man is up by 13 points among Republicans in Iowa right now.
Yeah, it just blows me away. There's a lot of people who condemn the one who...
I could huff gasoline for 24 solid hours and still not find a way to vote for Mike Huckabee. What does that say for the people who think that he's just the guy in Iowa?
They're crap. Well, actually,
I mean, do you realize what happens if the knuckle walkers and the mouth breathers in the Republican Party choose him in South Carolina and Iowa, and he comes in something like maybe second or third in New Hampshire?
Yep.
That means Romney's done, Giuliani's done, Fred Thompson is done.
Mm-hmm.
That means the skids are greased for Brother Mike.
Yep. And he's scary. He is scary. Let me put it this way. If he manages to get into the White House,
mm-hmm.
I'm gone. I'm leaving.
You know, it's interesting. I've said that a lot of times, but in this particular instance, I feel particularly, I said last night, you know, Brother Mike Huckabee gets in the White House, I'm not going to be seeking any more funds to run the horn. I'm going to see if maybe people will front up enough money to get me the hell out of America.
Can I call?
Pack a suitcase. Why, hell, you're a lot closer than I am.
I wonder, would the Canadian government consider it a importable skill if we brought our own network with us?
I don't know if being able to run my miserable yap is a skill or not, but I'd be willing to try.
Well, you probably could. I wonder, maybe what I should do is go move in with you guys temporarily, since you can teach me how to run the board and I'll have a skill.
Yeah, it's a learnable skill, no doubt about it. I'm up against the news, Susan. Good to talk to you, dear.
No problem.
Bye.
Love, Agnes.
Don't forget, submit now.
Bonsoir.
Talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye. News is coming. We'll be back. You're listening to America's Liberal Voice. You're listening to The Horn, listener-supported. For as long as you support it, we'll be here. We'll be back.
This is the Quality News Network. The death toll has risen to as many as 76 in this morning's twin bombings in Algiers, targeting foreigners and the country's Supreme Court. More than 40 have been wounded. The death toll is expected to rise. People are still trapped in the ruins of the offices run by the UN's Refugee Assistance Group. The man Russia's President Vladimir Putin named to replace him says he will, in turn, appoint Putin to continue to rule the country as prime minister. The nation's midsection belted with snow and ice today. Widespread power outages reported, roads and airports shut down. At least 17 deaths are being blamed on the weather. The Federal Reserve cut a key interest rate by 0.25 percentage point to 4.25%. It is the third rate cut in 3 months. The prime lending rate is now down to 7.25%. That's the lowest level in 2 years. CIA Director Michael Hayden's testimony on Capitol Hill today left some questions unanswered. That's according to Intelligence Committee Chairman Jay Rockefeller. Democrats want to know who authorized the destruction of interrogation tapes made in 2002 and why Congress wasn't told about it. Iraq's National Security Advisor says his country will never allow the U.S. to maintain permanent military bases in Iraq. Today he announced economic, political, and diplomatic support would be welcome, but Baghdad refuses a permanent military presence. In Baghdad this morning, a car bomb exploded outside the homes of two important Iraqi officials, including the country's former prime minister. Two policemen were killed, 13 were wounded. Talks between Israeli and Palestinian leaders start tomorrow. They are the first formal peace negotiations in 7 years. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert has pledged strong support for the establishment of an independent Palestinian state. Meantime, in Gaza City, Israeli forces moved over the border today in a new military operation targeting Hamas militants. Some 60 Palestinians were seized in house-to-house searches. 5 were killed. For the first time in more than 50 years, a cargo train crossed freely between North and South Korea today. The historic trip signals a new spirit of cooperation between the two countries. You're listening to the Quality News Network. We'll take a break. Be right back.
Want to start off the new year with a global internet presence but confused by all the ads for websites? Let Carmel.com and Boulevard's New Media give your business the gift of an internet page and internet advertising without all the worries. Get the results you want from internet advertising. Carmel.com provides the production graphics, designs, and writes your own unique web page. We brand your own logo and link global visitors to your page on Carmel.com. And we optimize your brand in all of our top city.com sites. We offer free toll-free numbers that connect direct to your phone line, free booking engines for hotels and inns. And we offer low monthly rates for retail and service businesses with all of your production costs free. So why wait another year for a web page? Give your business the benefits of Carmel.com's internet advertising with your free web page. Call us at 831-624-8889 or email contact at Carmel.com.
The city of San Francisco has filed suit against the owner and operator of a ship that spilled more than 58,000 gallons of oil into Bay Area waters last month. The suit contends the ship was operated under unsafe conditions and the crew took too long to respond to the accident. A telephone hotline designed to help over a million subprime borrowers received a record 45,000 calls in 3 days following the president's plan to freeze interest rates on certain subprime loans before scheduled jumps in monthly payments. U.S. and Chinese trade negotiators today signed two agreements designed to improve the safety of China-produced goods imported into America. Financial analysts say China's staggering foreign trade surplus indicates safety recalls of Chinese goods have not dampened the world's appetite for cheap Chinese products. This year, China's global trade surplus increased more than 50%. Shares of Texas Instruments rose nearly 5% following the company's prediction in sales and profits are expected to hit the high end of its quarterly forecast. TI produces chips for nearly half the world's cell phones. At today's close of Wall Street, a big drop on the Dow. The Dow Jones Industrial Average down 294 points to end at 13,432. NASDAQ down 66 points. The S&P 500 off 38. More at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Barbara Lewis.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
We enter hour number two with a quick program reminder or announcement. Strictly Confidential with Peter Godbold will be a rerun this evening. Peter has been in computer hell for the last couple of days and is just completely zonked by the process because it's the kind of work where one has to start before the sun comes up and then can't finish until everybody's gone from the joint. And I heard from him about noonish today to say that he was absolutely licked from the efforts and that he would do everything in his power to get back tomorrow evening, which will, of course, be Wednesday. We're going to go straight to the phones for a sort of a, well, a dual conversation in a moment or two here. Somebody remind me when we're done, let's talk about HRES 847. That's completely off topic. But I just got that in my email, and that's the, well, I don't know, maybe we'll save it for a prayer meeting. But it's the silliest thing I've ever seen in my entire existence, maybe. But right now, something entirely far more serious, and that is a discussion of the current state of affairs on the Mississippi Gulf Coast, because, you know, there's really not that many people who are doing, who are talking about the current state of affairs on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. I think there's a sort of a collective wish in the hearts and minds of a lot of America, you know, the America that's concerned with whether the aging star of an old cop show can dance, you know, what I was talking about a little bit ago, that, yeah, well, you know, we haven't heard anything about it in a while, so everything's okay. Everything is not okay. And on the phone with us, we have two people. One you already know, and that is our very own Kate, who is down on the Gulf Coast right now, and she is with us. Kate, are you there?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call, Bob.
Oh, stop that.
Hello.
Hello. Also with us is Ann Keating. Ann is a Chicago native who has done considerable work down there in the aftermath of Katrina. Ann, are you there?
Yes, I am, Bob. Thank you for taking my call as well.
You stop it too, okay?
Okay.
Got a couple of comedians on the line. Lucky me, I'd have to go to the Funny Bone and, you know, pay good money, but, you know, here I could just get it for free.
There you go.
But I'm glad we can start out with a little bit of pleasant banter and a chuckle, because I have a sneaking suspicion that's not going to last, is it?
No.
Perhaps.
Things are not good here at all. They're actually worse than they were when I was here 18 months out from the storm. The storm was the 29th of August, 2005, and things are, in a lot of areas, what was bad then when I was here, they're worse now. So that's not good news.
No. Ann, if you would, get us started, please. Tell us a little bit about your experiences in the region.
Certainly. You know, I think it may prove helpful to point out that luckily the first time that I was down there was just after February of this year, whereupon I connected with Kate, and we were able to be down there together, and she just proved incredibly beneficial in connecting me with various NGOs that are working on the ground and community organizations. And then I happened to be down there a few more times where Kate wasn't. So I have that perspective, and now Kate's back and I'm back in Chicago. So I think as we tag team each other, I think this will help elucidate the entire picture of what's going on. I had what started me going down there was I was listening to a benefit on December 31st, excuse me, on New Year's Eve about the region, but primarily focused on New Orleans. And I have been an avid fan of Mike Malloy, and he used to...
As am I. So,
great. Good to hear. He's a great guy. And so he used to broadcast up here in Chicago, and then I found him again once on the radio and began streaming his program, and happened to hear shortly after the program I watched on New Year's Eve, Sarge, a gentleman by the name of Sarge, who I'm sure you're well aware of.
We know him well, yes.
Yep, called in, and he was talking about the plight of the Mississippi Gulf Coast victims, or survivors, as I like to think of them. And I began to realize that we are getting nothing, I mean absolutely no news coverage up here whatsoever to do with Mississippi. And I'm currently in graduate school, and I thought, I began to just kind of think around in my mind what I might do, and I thought, you know, I think I want to go down there. I'm going for a master's, I'm doing my master's thesis in post-traumatic stress disorder in the elderly post-a-disaster. And I began thinking about that after the 1995 heat wave that we lived through here in Chicago, where we lost hundreds and hundreds of elderly. And some of the policies that had been implemented here in Chicago, and wondered, I wonder if they've imposed any of those in Mississippi. And hence my travel started. When I got down there, I could scarcely believe my eyes. Conditions were absolutely deplorable. And that was now 1.5 years after the original hurricanes hit. And I was stupefied by what I had seen down there on the ground with my own eyes, as opposed to the lack of reporting in the general, what would be called the mainstream media up here, and found that the scope of the problem certainly affected far more than the elderly. I couldn't believe my eyes at what I had seen. And I think that it's worthy to note that my father was a retired fire captain from up here in Chicago, and my uncle had been a director of homicide up here and a deputy superintendent, and the whole family comes from that background. And I had changed careers. I was in the financial markets for most of my life, and then I started to pursue a degree in psychology, and am an addictions counselor here in Illinois. And when I got down there, I thought I would be dealing with issues surrounding mental health and being able to assess those through my filming, my interviewing, and my observation, and began to realize that there was no way possible that you could begin to look at psychological issues when, you know, if you're familiar, as I'm sure you are, and your guests and your listeners are, to Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Sure, yeah.
On the bottom of it, I mean, it's survival. And you can't even begin to address the deeper psychological issues, such as post-traumatic stress disorder.
Well, it goes without saying, doesn't it, Anne, that the primary component of post-traumatic stress disorder is that the stress and the trauma, you have to be post it before you can start assessing it.
Correct.
And these people are not post. They are in tear.
Spot on. They're still in survival mode in many instances from all of my observations and my trips down there. And it was absolutely appalling. And I would find, Bob, that I would come back to Chicago and I would share my findings either by my writings or by my telling of stories to friends, family, whomever were interested. And they would literally look at me like I was crazy or I was just plain wrong. This could not possibly be. You know, when I would begin to describe the fact that it would be as if a bomb dropped on a neighborhood here in Chicago. And I'm thinking in particular, the first time I saw Paz Christian, and I said, all that would be left on your block and blocks surrounding you were slabs. There was no housing, no stores, no nothing. You know, people worked, everything was gone. They would look at me with an incredulous look on their face. And I said, no, this is exactly what I've seen. To say nothing of uprooted trees, people living in trailers, et cetera. I mean, I'm sure all of your listeners are aware.
Sewage issues, the works.
Yeah, everything. Everything. Couldn't believe it. Couldn't believe it.
Right down to the dead.
Oh, everything. Oh, yeah. In all kinds of piles of debris, there were bodies. Yeah.
I mean, if you're coming from a psychological background, and I've wondered sometimes how people or if people have managed to even be able to enter, let alone complete, the grief process there.
Oh, not at all. No. Didn't even. And you would see it in spots insofar as the loss of loved ones, either during the hurricane or post, you know, events that happened to them after the hurricane. That were directly resulting from the hurricane, but the lack of medical care, the lack of education rebuilt for children, housing, just your basic needs that one would need. I mean, if you were to tell me that I had to survive in my home for, say, I'm thinking of one instance, some 18 to 19 months without a hot water heater, I would look at you like you were out of your mind. I mean, it's like having a telephone. You'd have to tell me, you know, what are you talking about? And then as Kate was kind enough to begin to introduce me to people and show me around, both in the homes that, the shells of many homes that still remained, and trailers of other people, I was horrified. I mean, you would literally walk on a floor, and you could walk through the baseboard of the floor. You would open a door. There might be some kind of vermin inside of the door eating the wiring. Roofs were still out. You know, to say nothing of the, and then in the trailers themselves, the smell of the formaldehyde, the propane, sewage. Good thing I must say I did learn from my homicide detective uncle. One puts Vicks underneath their nostrils when you're walking into these types of situations. I mean, it was normal banter for me as a child growing up around the dinner table to listen to people who had encountered devastations of all kinds, and so I kind of knew what to do from my dad and from my uncle and my grandfather and other uncles. So I wasn't afraid, and I must say this as well. I think because of the way that I was raised, it's not enough for me to read reports, garner information that I can from an internet show such as your own. I have to go for and see for myself.
Yeah.
So I bought a camera and I went down there and I got informed consent from whomever I could, and I filmed them and I made it clear it was for a thesis project and it was also for wider dissemination to attempt to get help for them from whomever could supply that for them. And I do want to say something else about the psychological needs. Ordinarily, as you well know, when a person is assessed for their psychological status, shall we say, those tests are administered by trained professionals, ordinarily psychologists, sometimes psychiatrists. The tests are pretty, you know, extensive. You watch body language, you watch ability to answer questions, you watch the all kinds of, you know, means in which you assess them. I was appalled to find that people who even had the wherewithal to get in touch with organizations down there who were able to do that testing, if they were lucky, they would receive a questionnaire in the mail. That questionnaire then would be completed by them, sent back to the agency. If deemed necessary, the agency would then give them a stipend of, say, $2,000 for medical treatment. Well, this is a self-evaluating questionnaire. And as we know, with our returning soldiers at this time, I mean, this is no secret, you know, people are very reticent.
Resistant.
Yes?
Resistant to the idea of, if I understand where you're going, Anne, even in the midst of this kind of trauma, this kind of torment, this kind of hell, resistant to the idea of saying, you know, I desperately need help.
Yeah, correct. Or even if, and then you also have to factor in illiteracy rates. You have to factor in how the framing of those questions are. Are they framed in the language or the vernacular of a particular culture? You know, one must be sensitive to those issues as well. And I was appalled. How can you possibly assess something like that?
In other words, the entire process as you witnessed it was devoid of everything that you said is SOP for doing that kind of assessment.
Breakdown. Total breakdown. And I was also further, being a certified addiction and other dependency counselor, CADC, up here in Illinois, I was absolutely stupefied to find that I, just as a visitor down there, besides two other individuals, one being Jim Yancey, whom I know you know.
Yes.
And I do not know the name of the other individual, are the only two CADCs down in the Gulf Coast regions in those particular counties.
Why aren't there like three dozen?
Please tell me.
No, I'm not trying to be facetious, Ann.
No, I know.
Because and if you've talked with Kate much at all, you know that I have this ugly tendency of extrapolating things from other places. I ran across a story yesterday in the New York Times that was provided to us by one of our bloggers that talked about the fact that the Social Security Administration is getting ready to add 150 new administrative law judges to deal with a backlog of 775,000 disability claims.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This smacks of rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic.
Absolutely. And I also
and it's this it's the same thing. It's the same mindset. The same inability to provide the kind of needs meeting structure that you're describing on the Mississippi Gulf Coast is it comes from the same mindset that says 775,000 backlog of disability cases in Social Security is okay there too.
Mm-hmm.
There is a hierarchy in this country,
yes.
And I'm not trying to sound like a conspiracy theorist. I'm not.
No, I agree with you.
There's a hierarchy in this country that wants these systems. Not just, they're not just incapable. They are engaged in the active pursuit of the breakdown of this system.
I totally agree with you. Yeah, and I have a little bit more to say about that later too. And when I speak with Kate, and she tells me there's X amount of caseworkers who are going out and assessing, those are caseloads that are far beyond the kin that we would see here in Chicago.
What is okay? Let's try to establish some sort of a benchmark, Ann.
They're not even social workers.
But what kind of a caseload is reasonable if you were dealing with people who were trained professionals?
Well, I might have somebody that tells me. I can tell you for a fact that I know an individual who is an LCSW up here in Chicago. Works in a county called DuPage, all right, that is just adjacent to Chicago. She had a caseload of 90 clients and said that she was so burned out she had to leave her job. And that's intense. You know, that's not just going out, finding out if you need sheetrock, finding out if you need nails or plumbing.
No, that's 90. That's 90 human beings, a slip-up with any one of whom can result in abject disaster.
But they have housing. They have food. They have medical attention. They have their basic needs already met. Here's where the line gets cut. They're coming in because of cases of chemical addiction. They're coming in because of clinical depression. They may be coming in because of schizophrenia, any number of other, you know, psychological maladies that, you know, that need addressing. And in tandem, have a psychiatrist and or a medical doctor that can evaluate them there for prescription drugs that can help ameliorate these things, that can get them into some kind of recovery program. We're not even at that point down there in Mississippi from what I saw.
Not at all.
Kate, these are past observations from Ann. Does this jibe with your present?
No, not at all, because it's worse. The case managers typically they have an hour of case management training to learn how to fill in the paperwork, and usually they're like with an AA degree and whatever you get, you know, for counseling or something. Very few, I would say, there are probably very few with bachelor's or master's in. I mean, why would you work down here with a master's degree when you could be working somewhere else for more money? But that's not the point. When I was down here, we had a drawer of probably 60 working clients and about up to 85 who were, you know, we were kind of waiting on the grant to come through, and they, you know, they weren't back in the state yet, and they, whatever. And so that was like 60. We were just working as hard as we could. When I got to this agency, we have, I checked this figure yesterday, we have 1,666 working open files and many, many, many more intakes that aren't even processed yet. And we, like, I'm...
And how many people to work them?
Many, yeah. Well, I'm administrative support for a 5-county agency that does advocacy for disabled and elderly, and this agency lost 3 staff positions in the last 4 months, and there are probably 4, 5.
Kate, what do you mean lost?
The funding got cut back. The funding that the agency got from international and national and government donations and support, you know, grants and all that big boo-ha-ha money that they all got.
My eyes are about to start crossing, Kate. How do you cut
3 positions in an agency that's covering 5 counties?
In these circumstances, yeah. I mean, how do you...
I don't know. So that cuts us back to about 4 active case managers, 5 maybe, and I haven't met one of them. She's working off-site. And then we're going to stop taking new clients on the 31st of December because the agency's lost funding after March. They have to close down, and we just can't process it. So I said, but what are we going to do with these 2,000 clients? And they just looked at me like, we don't know. We're probably going to give them over to Rebuild Jackson County, which is a huge, big agency down here that I'm not real clear about who and what they are. I guess they'll be given over to Rebuild Jackson County. But the caseload is way worse than it was when you were here.
Yeah. I can.
And the agency that I was with before had to shut down. They lost their building. They lost their staff. We were totally worked with volunteers. The AmeriCorps teams come in, and they did case management, and they were trained in a couple hours. They were kids fresh out of high school, and they go out and assess the needs and knew how to fill out the paperwork, but they didn't know squat about nothing else. But that's how we worked. You know, I mean, we did the best we could. And then the AmeriCorps team leaves every 6 weeks, and we start with a new spike. And it's just it's pretty bad. You know, I mean,
there's a logistical issue here, unless I'm completely missing the point. One could easily say, well, listen, you know, there's a crisis here. We need X number of people doing this, Y number of people doing that, on and on. And you bring them from wherever you can get them, and you fill the need that way. But then you've created a vacuum wherever it is that the people are coming from. How do you, I mean,
very difficult question.
I ask this question every day.
And I really, at this point, I think, in order for us to start to get help in these areas, I think we have to start looking at this as a public policy, because I began this whole project in attempting to assess the elderly for these needs, and came to find that that is an impossibility. You cannot just assess the elderly because so many of the elderly are raising grandchildren.
Yes.
They have extended family, you know, either their own parents or brothers and sisters that they're trying to care for. They're ill themselves. And so we have to change the framework on this. This has become my mantra, practically. We have to start looking at this not just as a case-by-case basis in any one area, although this is horrific, and I do not mean by any stretch of the imagination to downplay it, but we have to begin to look at these issues in our country as public health and public policy issues.
Crises.
I'm sorry?
Yeah. Crises.
Yeah,
not just an issue, it's a
yes.
Crisis.
Yes, it is. It is.
And I'm just trying to think of it, and Kate, I know you have some sort of systems analysis background and stuff. What do you, I mean, do you post flyers for the kids who are graduating with a BA in social work and say, you know, come and make your bones on the ground here? Because it sounds to me like there is either the system is so horribly broken that it cannot address the needs, or else what services are located in places such that you can't get to where the need can be met.
That's another problem. Yeah.
Yeah. These are multi-tiered and multifaceted problems. Yes.
Well, who's putting the skull sweat into fixing it? I mean,
nobody. I started to say a while ago, I have some pretty strong feelings about, and they're usually inappropriate in national interviews, but if you'll notice, the people who aren't getting served, either in Chicago or in Jackson County or Hancock or Harrison County on the Gulf Coast, are black, brown, and tan. Or white, also.
They share a commonality of poor, and then it diverges into a majority of black, brown, and tan.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Correct. Well, because mm-hmm. of the, mm-hmm. yeah.
Just because
it was, yeah. It was, I was here about 4 days last January, and when I was introduced to a lot of people in Moss Point, which is Mississippi's the poorest state in the Union, Jackson County is the poorest county per capita in Mississippi, and Moss Point is the poorest city in Jackson County. And I said to somebody, this is genocide, and they looked at me they looked at me funny like, oh, no, that's the old South. It's not like that anymore, Ms. Kate. And so I'd look at one of the sisters, and I'd say, isn't there institutional racism going on here? And she rolled her eyes and shrugged and kind of grinned, that little sideways grin. And I said, oh, thank you. Now people, you two even alluded to it about 20 minutes ago. What has happened? Why are we doing this? Who are these people who aren't getting served? And I'm so relieved to hear people start talking that way, because it's just the government's trying to buy up land out past Pascagoula and Bay St. Louis because they don't want people to rebuild on them. They say it's for safety issues. That's crap. Mm-hmm. They want it for corporations. They want it for...
If it's for safety issues, I mean, I understand, to be clear, I understand at least some part of the purpose of barrier islands along coastal areas.
Mm-hmm.
They literally protect the inner coast.
Absolutely.
And it's probably a good idea not to build on them.
Correct. Yeah.
So on the one hand, if you were to say this is for safety reasons and we're going to depopulate the area, and okay, I understand that. But if I turn around 2 years later and there's a casino sitting on it.
I was just going to say that.
Thank you.
I was going to say, if these are safety issues, then please explain to me why the only people that seem to have profited by this are the casinos that have come off of the barges in the Gulf of in Mississippi and then been placed on land. And when I rode down there, when I was down there in August, the end of August, and I rode along before I started to come home, I'm not only seeing the casinos being rebuilt on land, I'm seeing luxury condos, resorts, townhomes, and I'm also seeing Mississippi Power and Electric being placed at the intersection of, I forget the one that goes through Biloxi up to
road. Their main headquarters building sitting right out on the beach.
It's right on the beach on 90. Mississippi Power. Now you tell me
what
kind of a safety measure.
Yes. I'll send you pictures. It's wonderful.
I'm telling you. I thought I was going to get in a car crash.
And so what? They work on problems of the grid under an old Cabana Boy.
Right, exactly. You put the grid right in the middle. Why don't you just place it right out there, you know?
Yeah, just hang the high-tension wire out and stick it in the water.
No, exactly. It's more like the admin building, and I don't know that there were across the road there were the big high tension power lines and stuff, and
I do want to echo something that Kate said too, and I was hesitant to use that word. I'm really glad that you brought it up. I have come to realize, from a moral standpoint, that I can watch Darfur, you know, on CNN or, you know, various Zimbabwe, et cetera. Well, this is nothing less than, and this is a very strong statement to make, but this is nothing less than genocide that is occurring in our own country. And until we are ready to get out of the denial and start facing what's going on in our own country, and I don't care what city you live in, what rural community, what town you are in, unless you're willing to step out of that denial and start facing the facts that if you think that this can just happen in one region of the country, or just because of a hurricane.
It can happen to poor white, brown, black, and tan people all over America.
But also, tornadoes can happen anywhere. I happen to live right next to Tornado Alley up here in Chicago. You know, earthquakes can happen. Look at San Francisco. Oil spills can happen. And unless we must face the fact that now, from a public policy standpoint, that we are no longer going to be able to rely upon our government the way that we thought we would.
Is and I must ask you, is that what they wanted all along?
I don't know. I'm beginning to believe that.
And they broke it, and they want to make sure it can never be rebuilt. I'm talking about a system that can respond to a natural disaster of the scope of a Katrina. You know, whether it's Grover Norquist suggesting that he wants to reduce government to the size that it could be drowned in a bathtub.
Right. Right.
They've gotten their wish, because even now the people who are most committed to the idea of recovering from this and doing it sooner rather than later, I'm hearing you say, Ann, that some of your willingness to believe that it can be accomplished has been largely defeated.
And don't you think, Naomi Klein recently put out the Shock and Awe Doctrine on economics. Well, one need not do anything. All one need do is step back and accomplish that by pure neglect, by doing nothing at all.
Yeah. All that is needed for evil to triumph is for good people to do nothing.
Absolutely. All you have to do is take a step back and then have the rest of the world think that because it's not being reported upon, then everything must be hunky-dory.
That's right.
I think of my own father. He was a professional firefighter here in Chicago, ergo got paid. But I began to look at this in terms of volunteer firefighters, in rural communities. One may be, for instance, an accountant by day or a doctor, but once those, sirens go off at night in the community, it's almost Pavlovian. They will throw their fire boots on and get their hats and out the door they go, and they put out the fire in the community. And therefore save lives, save homes, save property, etc. Well, I'm beginning to believe that this is going to have to become a grassroots institutional effort that we are going to have to really begin to form within our own communities. The needs in cities, the needs in counties, and the needs in wherever you live are going to differ from place to place. They're going to have to start within families. Those families are going to have to branch out into the blocks surrounding them. Then from there, the concentric circles must widen depending upon where it is you come from.
Well,
we are going to have to learn how to take care of ourselves. And I don't know exactly how that's going to occur, because it's going to have to be, it's going to have to be decided by the people in the community themselves.
You make me think of a couple of things, one of them being that when you described what happened when the alarm goes off in the middle of the night and the fire crew races to get its coat and boots and hats and axes and jumps on the fire engine and goes, they don't ask what the economic status is.
Absolutely.
Of the person whose house is burning down, because there is a vested interest in stopping that fire then to keep the fire from spreading regardless of whose house it's going to next.
I might just let you know something that my dad told me when I mentioned this to him the first time. My father said, not only is there a vested interest in that, but he said, and as firefighters, we take an oath to do that. We are bound by oath.
But you see, what happened on the Gulf Coast, and it was... And I include I see New Orleans and the Mississippi Gulf Coast as two separate problems.
Two separate entities.
I do too. Thank you.
But they are equally horrific.
Correct. Mm-hmm. I never mean to compare one against.
And what I saw and to this day, I mean, if something related to the aftermath of Katrina is mentioned on Fox News or with some right wing blatherhead like Limbaugh or Hannity or you know, that
yeah.
crowd,
right.
that sense of a vested interest is completely gone. If it ever existed at all. And the first thing you hear is, well, that's those people's problem. They was living below sea level. Or that's those people's problem. They knew where they lived. They live in hurricane country. Why didn't they get out of the way?
That's right. And many of them could not.
On public transportation, right.
And not only that, many of them just cannot. They are not mobile. What about the disabled? What about
sure.
the people who are left to care for elderly?
And what scares the life out of me is we are moving into an America that is so thoroughly broken, so utterly dysfunctional,
mm-hmm.
that we can't muster that innately American sense of that shared vested interest.
Right, mm-mm. And so we're going to have to get ways in which, and even if it has to be so basic as saying, you know, Joe down the block there, he can keep water, you know, X amount of gallons of water in his home, but so can Tom across the street in case something happens to Joe's house. And Steve down the road has such and such a pickup truck, Mary's a nurse. Bob up there owns the gas station. If we have to, you know, so-and-so is going to go and siphon all the gas. So-and-so is going to have to store, like, stockpiles of food. Somebody else is going to have to be their backup to do that in the event that there's a disaster. Whatever the specific community needs, they're going to have to band together, and they're going to have some kind of a plan among themselves to do this. And I will bring in another issue that I'm reticent to bring in, but I'm just gonna throw it out there right now, because if we don't do something like this for ourselves and begin to take control back for ourselves, what we will see is we will see the black waters come into our neighborhood. And they're the ones that are going to have the controls, the helicopters, the water, the food, et cetera, and they're going to control who gets it, when they get it, where they get it. And the other thing is, if a community, and this is a basic tenet in psychology, the first thing you do is the installation of hope. If you empower people, you give them hope. So if they know that, like, when that fire bell goes off in the rural communities and they know they got to don their fire gear and get out there, well, if they know something's coming and they know, okay, this is my job, I have the water, so does Joe down the block or whoever, and if something happens to Joe, I have this water stored in my home, or Joe has it in case something happens to me, I have something I can do about it. You take the person out of the framework of victim and move them into survival. Once you move them into survival, you start to ameliorate the fear. Everyone's going to have fear, but you start to ameliorate them because they know there's something that they can do about it, and they're not left in the position to stand around and wait for help to come.
They can act instead of simply being acted upon.
Absolutely.
Well, Kate, is there any of that? I mean, you say it's worse now than what it was. Is there any of that? Is there any of that movement toward hope?
I haven't been out in the community. I've been chained to the desk and the computer and the telephone since I got here last Sunday, and so I haven't really been out in the community to see for myself, except I did write around to all of the clients that I had when I left here in March, and there were 14 of them, and they were all unfinished. There wasn't any evidence that their homes, that their jobs had been finished. And three of them had never lived in a trailer, but there were only two trailers that had been removed from the property, and wasn't evident that the people were back in the house necessarily. So that was one thing. And so I don't know what kind of community effort there is going on. I haven't gotten a sense of the drumbeat there. But what you're talking about the recovery that what you're bringing up, Ann, about the, who's got the water, who's got the chainsaw, the women down the road have the chainsaws, non-Western kind of attitude, more like a village attitude.
Exactly.
And it's when I left here, I just need to tell a brief anecdote, but so I don't have to talk for the rest of the hour about what I'm doing. There was a woman who I went to her sister's house to see, and she was just so mad because everybody up and down the street was just making garbage, and I mean nothing was getting done, and she's just this feisty little utilities worker she's this feisty little thing with a little hat on and the radio and stuff. And she's crossed her arms and she goes, this should have been done a year ago. Everybody's just sitting around waiting on somebody to come and do it and finish it for them. And they're just waiting, and we could have been done here a long time ago. And she just went on and on, and I thought, oh, yeah, that's my attitude, too. And so I called her the village queen. And I talked to her again tonight, and she's just glad I'm back. And I went to visit another woman who was just in a quandary because her carpenters weren't doing the right thing, and the contractor messed up this and then still wanted more money. And her ceramic tile wasn't even like, she said, oh, it's such a mess. I just can't take this anymore. And I said, sister, you can lay that tile yourself. Anybody can cut tile. I can? And I said, yeah. I mean, boys do it. You can. You just rent a tile saw, and you put the water to it, and you have somebody show you. Go to the Lowe's class and show them. They'll show you how to cut tile, and then you buy the tile from them, and you've already got the tile. You put the glue, and then you put the little spacers here, and then you walk away and use the other rooms until it's dry. Oh, I could do that, couldn't I? And I said, yeah. So I had to leave, and I came away from there thinking, I spent the whole summer in Arizona thinking, how can we make this happen? And I called a couple of the sisters who were kind of active in the community, and I said, do you know anybody who's a mover and a shaker, who's probably retired, but really common sense, but really radical? And everybody goes, oh, yeah, her. And I said, we can just sit down in the church and in the kitchen and just sit and talk about how we can take it back, how we can do it ourselves. We can't wait for the brothers and the husbands and the uncles and the grandpas to do it for it. They just didn't come. They aren't coming. The kids, the elder sons, they aren't coming. They got their own deal going on. The government ain't coming. We can do this ourselves. And they said,
ain't no cavalry, ain't no rescue.
Right. Yeah, and they gave me a couple of names, and I said, oh, okay. So I had that in the back of my mind in my little notebook scribbled in the back, and I sat down in I've been here since 8 o'clock Sunday night. I sat down at 7:30 on Monday morning at a meeting and looked across the table, and I said, is that what she said? Yeah, and I said, oh, my goodness. So as a result of that, we have a meeting scheduled at 6:30 in Moss Point next Monday night for empowerment, just the empowerment of women. You know,
good.
She said, I think that's a wonderful idea, that we have got to do that. We have got to do that.
Will you pardon me, Kate, if I say that if you succeed, that's the kind of thing that scares the absolute
the brothers out of the
power base?
Oh, hell yeah. That's why I'm doing it.
We have to do that.
Yeah. Huh? Yeah. I mean, they've had 2 years to show up, okay? So get scared.
Right.
Handle it.
And you know, Yeah, the other thing, Bob, that just horrified me, not my last trip, but the trip before that I was down there, I was talking to a young gentleman, I say young, 35 years old. He has some children of his own, and he gave me a statistic that I don't know. I have not yet been able to verify. However, he told me that 41% of the school-age children have yet to go back to school. And what they do during the day is they live out in the forest, you know, so that they can elude the police or truant officers, whomever it may be. And then at night they come into town and they either rob or they do whatever, or they're beginning to engage more in, you know, drugs and illicit behavior, et cetera. Well, my point with this, we have to become empowered ourselves Mm-hmm. You know, if my dad's a retired fireman, right? Now, he's 84 years old. He can obviously not be leading hose out, you know, to fight a fire.
Right.
But maybe the guy across the street, Mike, maybe he was a retired architect or contractor. He can't be carrying a 2x4 or a 4x8. But his neighbor, John or whoever, now he might be a 21 or an 18-year-old or a 16-year-old, you know, strapping young fella, who he can say to that guy, okay, here's what we're going to do with your grandma's house. I'm going to go to the store with you. I'm going to show you, you know, what you buy, what you haul in, what you start working on, and start educating them. A, they're learning a skill they didn't have.
And the hardest job in the world is reinventing the wheel.
Yeah, but boy.
And as a consequence of that, what you're talking about, you take people who have skills who may not be able to use them the way they once did. But if they can tell the next generation down or the generation below them,
exactly,
look, this, you know, just do what I tell you, put the board there, drive the nail.
Right, and the kid then isn't going to get in trouble. That's my point. That's the other point. You're giving them a skill, you're giving them a job, and then they're not going to flounder out there and then find themselves in some kind of trouble. Because, Bob, I swear to you, there will come a day, I may never live to see it, but there are going to be questions, and these will be rhetorical, that our children or grandchildren will ask us. And they're going to say something to you like, what did you do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where were you? What could you have done? Didn't you know this was going to happen? How will the parents, the grandparents, the great-grandparents, or people, the teachers, you and I, anyone, answer those children? Will we throw our hands up in the air and say, well, I did the best I could? Well, maybe that's true. Maybe the person did do the best they could. Maybe that's an honest answer. But let's start looking at what we can do now. What's done's done. And we have to take back our power. And I'm telling you that as a country, as a nation, as a people, I mean, I've traveled all over this world. I've seen recovery and help and rebuilding projects happen faster in third world countries than I've seen them happen here in the United States in the last 8 years. And I'm telling you, if we continue with this apathy, we are going to be ashamed of who we are as a people. We have to take back our control and not leave it with the people who pretend like they own the power in this country.
Right on.
Well, if we don't, we're doomed, right?
You're darn right we are.
Yep.
We have to take this back. And we have to rely, and how you do that, if you listen to Tom Hartman even talk, he will tell you that anything that's ever come about in this country has come not from the people on high, but it has come from the grassroots movement.
Yes, and every successful revolution in the history of the world has come from the middle class.
Absolutely. And how do you do that? You begin to believe in yourself. You begin to get that hope back that you can do something about this. You are not a victim, and you are not a slave to these people. There is something that can.
And you all, but you, and you also, and frankly, this is a question maybe Ann, you can answer better than I. Maybe you already have. You have to reinvest that sense of the vested interest.
Exactly.
What, you know, ask not for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee sort of attitude.
Right.
That idea that what happens to my neighbor impacts me.
Absolutely.
That community is worth it.
Sermon on the Mount. If, you know, I mean, why don't we hear more about the Sermon on the Mount?
It's very inconvenient, that sermon.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it just? Yeah, bless
it's not good for the hedge fund managers.
No, evidently not. No, and believe me, and I've worked in the market.
Well, that's why I made that reference. Yeah.
I worked with a lot of them. I know it. But you know what? That's all. You know, the house that I'm sitting in tonight and I'm on the telephone with you, I began to realize once that I was in Mississippi, this could be gone in the flash of an eye. My body could be gone in a nanosecond. What have I got left? I've got left the heart, the humanity, the compassion, and the spirit that I've left behind. And if you're hurt, if anyone is hurt, if they're in India, if they're in China, if they're down the block, if they're wherever, if they hurt, whether I know it or not, I hurt.
I think about the soulless neglect that resulted in Rwanda.
Yes.
And you know, it replicates itself time and time again. We talk about a lot of coal-related issues here in West Virginia, and yet I had a story. I had a story in the news that 261 miners were killed in a Chinese coal mine disaster last week.
Yeah.
You know what? I doubt if at the moment that spark caused that mine to explode, anyone was reading Chairman Mao's Little Red Book or wondering about the finer points of Marxist economic theory.
Exactly. And it's not just, I mean, you talk about the barrier islands and the need to rebuild barrier islands, and that's so true from an ecological standpoint. But then you look at West Virginia and you look at, you know, mountaintop coal, you know, where they're just blasting the mountains off and polluting all of the lakes. All, you know, your fish are dying. The land is being ruined, and we cannot allow this.
Well, that ties into the question you asked, Ed, when we were out on that photo shoot. Where the pillars had been washed over. They were sunken concrete, like 6 feet of concrete, and they were big I-beams, and they were just like they were like rotten fence posts. They were just blown over. And I think it was you, or it might have been somebody else I took on that tour, said, why do people live here? And I said, look around. The birds were singing, the tide was in, there was a breeze, there was a nice warm sunshine, mm-hmm. the trees were green, it was gorgeous day.
I can see why they live here.
People live here because they love it, it's their home. Mm-hmm. I would ask the same question of, but it's unsafe. Well, but that's the same as living in West Virginia, it's unsafe.
Or in San Rafael, California. I mean, the house is right on cliff.
I mean, people.
You can live on a spot of land that is so confounded flat you can drop a marble and it won't move.
No,
you can live in Kansas or Nebraska and some crazy little bastard can come in with a gun and shoot up your mall,
mm-hmm.
or you can just wait for the big twister that takes it all.
That's exactly right.
Nobody's safe. Safe is a bogus word.
No, but you live where your heart is.
Sure you do. Right. Sure you do. But,
and that's why people live on the Gulf Coast.
The people in Mississippi, I mean, my grandparents were first generation here in the United States. They immigrated from Ireland. So many of the people that I've met down in Mississippi actually have greater claim to this land than I do. They've lived here more generations than I.
And there's lots of folks who can trace one side of their family or the other back to a group of Choctaw who came over from the Yucatan Peninsula.
Exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. Mm-hmm. So it's not a matter of, you can be unsafe, you can be walking down the street and get hit by a bus, you know? I mean, any number of, I totally agree with you, it's not a matter of safety, it's not a matter of place, if anything can happen at any time. A piece of ice could fall off of a building and kill you. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean,
and this all plays in to the constant terrorization of the American people. Mm-hmm. You know, when Katrina hit, we were already pretty well, and I'm not talking about you and me because we understand the nature of the con, if you will.
Yeah.
But a lot of America was already locked down tight in absolute concreted terror mode. scared to death that some Muslim was going to get them.
Exactly, exactly.
And as a consequence of that, when the real problem hit, which turned out not to be religious or Muslim or Christian or anybody else, it was, you know, weather-borne for the love of God, when that hit, we were screwed.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that's why my point, I guess I keep coming back to this, and I don't mean to be repetitious, but now we have to start to come out of this collective denial where we allow people to control our lives and scare the living hell out of us. If I can say that on the air.
You certainly can say that on the air. We say it rather frequently.
And we have to stop being like this. We have to say, no. No, I will not be afraid. I will take care of my family. I will take care of my community. I will do what I can. I will band together with others. And it's the only answer. It's the only answer left to us, is our civil liberties and our Constitution and our Bill of Rights are decimated. We now have to start taking back control. And I'm not talking about, you know, anything, you know, militant. I'm talking about really brass tacks, grassroots people coming together who are going to say, okay.
You mean actually finding out what your neighbor's name is?
How about it? And
you
don't talk about hard to do. I mean, it's hard in a big old city. My mother was from Brooklyn.
And once you don't think those sisters that we're going to start meeting Monday night at 6:30 are going to get militant? You don't think there's going to be a movement going on? Oh my! Even if it's only one or two people.
Well, Ann, Kate, if you don't mind, I'd like to interrupt this for just a moment. We have Jim who has called in with a question, I believe. Jim, are you there?
Oh, I'm still here.
Okay, good deal. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Good evening. How are you?
Oh,
hey, Jim.
Well.
How you doing?
Reasonably well. Well, you know, first, as far as solving problems are concerned, I wrote a paper on a fellow in graduate school, and he said there's a number of ways to solve problems. He says there's a soapbox, there's a jury box, there's a ballot box, and there's a cartridge box. So, you know, the history of this country, I think, has been used, or, excuse me, let me rephrase that, those methods of solution have been used throughout the history of this country. That's for sure.
I didn't quite get the end of that, Bob, if you could tell me.
Beg your pardon?
I didn't quite get the end of that. The soapbox, the jury box, the
ballot box, and
ballot
the cartridge
box, and the ammo box.
And the cartridge box.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yes, those have been time-honored solutions for many of America's problems, fortunately, unfortunately, depending on your point of view.
Well, luckily,
Bob has provided us a soapbox. And I look at this as the beginning. I really do. I look at this as the beginning. Venues such as this where I dread the day that we have to use the ammo box, to be honest with you. I would much prefer to use the soapbox and any other type of things where we can bring people together.
Well, I would make the argument that there hasn't been nearly enough soapbox in this particular dilemma.
I agree.
Insofar as it's... I remember the... And I viewed it as...
I'm just being reflective, not instructive, that's all.
Yeah, but I remember the what I viewed as semi-pornographic segment on Good Morning America and CNN's American Morning, the first Mardi Gras following Katrina, and you had these fools down there in the French Quarter saying, well, you know, it's not quite back up to speed, but things are going swimmingly here.
Right, right, right.
Well,
swimmingly.
You know,
yeah, pardon the pun.
This is one thing that causes me great concern, and this is much more concern for anything that a Katrina could cause. And just hear me out on this. Now, almost every week, I see programs that are dealing with this volcano in the Azores. And Cuba de Vieja. And their seismologists are predicting that this thing is going to fall in on itself. And it's going to displace enough territory, enough land, to create a tsunami that will be 300 meters high. And it will move across the ocean at a speed of approximately 600 miles per hour.
Right. Wow.
and it will strike the east coast of the United States all the way from Boston to Galveston.
Wow. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Now, if we can't deal with hurricane damage like Katrina, what are they going to do when they're going to have cities like Boston, New York, and New York's financial district being assaulted by a 100-meter wall of water, Washington, D.C., Charleston, South Carolina, Virginia Beach, Virginia, and how far is this thing going to go in? And can you imagine the social hydraulics that this would create?
And see, it's that kind of it's a process of dominoes, Jim. We learned a lot with Katrina, to a certain extent, Rita. We've learned a lot more in a different vein with the fires in Southern California.
Yes.
And it's not, and I think people fail to understand that it's not one thing that does you in.
That's right.
It's processual. Insofar as one thing knocks you down, the next thing kicks you, and the third one puts its boot on your throat.
Well, I would dare say that something like that will be do a very good job in knocking you down.
Look at up and down. We're talking about basically the mouth of the Mississippi River. Look at the New Madrid Fault. What was it? 1820 some maybe 1814.
Fourteen maybe.
When it last went absolutely bonkers, and there was no settlement of any significance. Memphis wasn't much of anything, and neither was St. Louis. But it's postulated that if that thing goes, you're going to have destruction such as we can't comprehend, because nothing in that region is engineered to withstand seismic activity.
No, it is not.
Well, for example, Yellowstone, for example,
which
is an extremely dangerous volcano, or it's a very dangerous fault, or whatever you want to call it. It's a very dangerous geological anomaly, for lack of a better term. It's one of the most dangerous in the world, and they're worried about it, because if that thing should go, then, of course, we could have this country split all the way with a body of water that goes from the Gulf all the way to the Great Lakes.
Yep.
And not just that. You know, we talk about Katrina as if it were an isolated incident. There was a warm-up, and that was Andrew, because the response to Andrew was not stellar.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. You're right. Absolutely.
What happened to Homestead, Florida was and the graft that followed it was sickening.
Bob, let me say this. I had a very good friend who worked for Office of Personnel Management, who's down with the CDC. Now, he was detailed to go down there and help with Andrew, and I would dare say there was probably more response for Andrew in terms of a lot of government that I knew back then.
Oh, there was.
There was with Katrina.
There absolutely was. And by the time Bill, that's what I'm trying to get at. We're looking, in a way, we're looking at one little tiny inset of a much larger picture, and it all matters, because one of the first things that Bill Clinton did when he became president was to elevate the head of FEMA to a cabinet-level position.
Exactly.
With cabinet-level authority.
And then when under Homeland Security.
Yeah, but even before then, one of the first things George W. Bush did was to demote FEMA out of the cabinet before 9/11 ever happened, before there was ever mention of Homeland Security.
Well, I think that tells you something about his perspicacity and knowledge of the situation.
Well, it also tells you something about his priorities.
Yeah, I was going to say, yes.
Well, absolutely. You know,
yeah, absolutely.
But I mean, when it starts coming into his own backyard, I think he's going to be sorry that he's done what he's done. But, you know, that's all I really have to say, ladies. I have a lot of concerns about a lot of things.
Wait, please.
I couldn't hear him, sorry.
And you can't hear Jim, and he was trying to say goodnight. He was trying to say goodnight and thank you.
Oh, thank you. I'm sorry.
It's good to hear you, Jim. Thanks.
Well,
for
I don't mean
thanks,
to,
Jim.
I don't
so
mean
sorry.
To sound like a prophet of doom, but these are things that I see every day, and you know, I do believe in what the seismologists are telling me.
Yeah.
Absolutely, and you have to identify this stuff. It's not being prophet of doom. You have to identify this stuff in order to prepare for it. And one of the things that we are dealing with is an utter, abject, miserable failure to prepare.
Well, we don't, absolutely.
Yeah, the mass media does not want to talk about the Azores, Jim. They do not. You do not hear. I mean, I'd be willing to venture that probably 85% of the listening audience tonight are saying, what the hell are they talking about?
Correct.
They wouldn't know about that because, you know.
No, nobody knows.
To tell you the truth, Kate, there is no way you can prepare for a tsunami like that.
No, there isn't.
Can you imagine the entire East Coast in Exodus have to be warned that within 6 to 7 hours they're going to be hit with a wall of water?
Right.
This X number of hundreds of feet high.
This ain't no Steven Spielberg movie.
No,
all we
it's
can
not.
Do is kiss our ass goodbye. And just be spiritually prepared. That's all. That's
well,
what it's all about anyway.
You're right.
That's what it's about.
Absolutely. But listen, I thank you both, and you have a good evening.
Thank you, Jim, and you as well.
And Merry Christmas to you both. And
you too.
Happy New Year to you and your friend, Kate, and I wish you well.
Bye now.
Thank you, Sam. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you so much, Jim. Happy holidays to you as well.
It just.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear.
No, that's okay. That tells me that I've got some sort of a strange little gremlin in the system yet that has to be worked out.
Okay.
Everything works for a while and then it goes kerflot. Someday, you know, we'll have a multi-million-dollar engineer and.
You bet.
Yeah. Really? On site as it is, we've got some of the most amazing engineering going. And that's, you know, what little bit I've learned from John Fox, and he's in Australia, and sometimes, and we just sit and turn this knob, Bob. Okay, no, that wasn't it. Turn the other one, Bob. Oh, look, we made it all better. But, no, this has been an absolutely enlightening and fascinating conversation for me, because, you know, it's been so far wide-ranging. It's philosophical in terms of why it has failed, how it can be rectified, and I suppose the one thing we may find ourselves wanting in this conversation so far is to concretely talk about what the failure means. The ceiling's leaking a little bit, and you know I got a bucket there, and that's not what this is it?
No, absolutely not. People are dying. They are literally dying. I sat in August in a FEMA trailer with a woman who is raising her 3 grandchildren. Her son is dead. Father died, couldn't evacuate during Katrina. Her dad was dying of cancer. She's raising her 3 grandchildren. They have no mom and dad now, and she takes care of a severely impaired brother of her own. And I sat in their trailer, and the little boy has, here's a real snapshot and a concrete example of this. One of the younger boys has had a kidney transplant. She feels that she's been very, very lucky that the doctor in New Orleans cut her medicines from 12, and these include anti-rejection drugs for the kidney, to 7, because she only has to pay for 2 out of pocket. In the meantime, since I've been home, Bush has cut the S-CHIP program to children.
Yes.
Ergo, she gets less money now, I'm sure. 1 month, she got $55 to feed 6 people, really, because she asked for extra money from the Salvation Army. They gave her what she needed. They gave her some extra money the next month when she went back for food stamps. She had been taken off of their rolls because she got that extra $155. You feed a family of 6 for $155. This particular trailer, it was evening, and it was like an oven. It was about 130 degrees inside of this trailer. My clothes were totally stuck to me. Even though her neighbor might know how to fix her air conditioning, and now with winter coming, her heating in case that goes out, they are not allowed to have anybody outside of a FEMA contractor come in and fix those particular trailers.
Still
so she had to wait until somebody could come in.
Now, because of weather conditions, it's my understanding that the pressed board inside of the trailers has further deteriorated. Ergo, more formaldehyde is being released in the air. People are becoming sicker and sicker. When do their houses get rebuilt? This is 2 more years. You know, you walk back into somebody else's home where they're still living in their home. They've got some things done, some things shoddily done, some things not done at all. And, I mean, you're walking on what would be remnant of carpet, you know, that somebody else gave them from God knows where. Don't know if it's been cleaned. Don't know what kind of disease and or, you know, virus, bugs, whatever, might be in there. My own observations, and this is just me, every time I come home, I'm sick. And I'm only down there for a couple of weeks at a time. I can walk out and I can look at my car, and I've never seen anything like this before in my life. Walk along the beach on the Mississippi Gulf, and that sand is like sugar. It's just...
Yes, it is. It's the most beautiful beaches in the world.
It's gorgeous. But if I come out of my hotel room, and we've not had a rainfall or we've not had some significant wind during the night, I've never seen anything like this. It is a brown silt that looks like tan talcum powder. That's the closest I can come up with.
Mm-hmm.
It covers everything.
Everybody's warm.
Yeah. Everybody's coughing. Everybody's sinuses are plugged. They all have infirmities as a result of this. If they did not have some type of lung involvement, bronchitis, asthma, sinus trouble, et cetera, they do have it now. Infirmities are worse.
And a resistant rash.
That's the newer thing that Kate just told me about.
Mm-hmm. And as a follow-up to your trailer lady,
mm-hmm.
The trailers are still sitting there. The same trailers are still sitting there. They're now covered with green mossy mold, like living under the trees, you know, with the humidity and the rain. The children are playing out in the street on Sunday afternoon. The brother's still sitting on the side step, staring, smoking cigarettes, and
suicide is up 200%.
Successful is 200. Attempts are 900.
Right.
Jeez, oh
and
my God.
Children, this is another stat that this might be an appropriate time to throw this in. There was a note, a short story on WLOX, the TV station here, that they were opening a new home for abused children. And they had purchased a seven, I don't have a cough button, I'm sorry, I have a mold cough.
That's okay.
Mississippi cough.
Bob, give me a cough button. No, never mind.
Kate.
Some adjacent cottages to house volunteers, and it's for abused and neglected children. And the man had said, who was the director of the home, said that abused and neglected children are up 300% since the storm, and they have lost 85% of their funding base. They used to have like 200 people and corporations or businesses a month contributions to their home, and now it's dropped off to 10. 10 people and businesses are contributing to their, but the children, the abused and neglected kids are up 300%, which ties into the little feral children bands that are running around the street that Ann was warned about.
Kate, Ann, the fact of the matter is, for all that we think that we are so civilized and so advanced, and Katrina proves it, Rwanda proves it, Darfur proves it, every miserable crisis on this planet proves it. We are, each and every one of us, minutes away from getting very much in touch with our barbarian roots.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Oh, Mad Max days are coming.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, coming, it sounds to me like they're already there where you are right now, Kate.
Kind of, yeah.
You just said feral bands of feral children. Okay. You said that in a context of an American inhabited region.
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay. That's pretty Mad Maxy in my book.
You bet. Mm-hmm. And the parents of the children, you remember where the grocery store was, Annie, where we went to get our picnics to go on the trip?
Absolutely.
Where you talked to that lady, the parents of the children who are running the street, I mean, it isn't obvious.
They've lost their ability to be parents.
Because
they've lost their ability to be human in many instances, have they not? And I'm not trying to be some sort of jerk here.
No, you walk through the grocery store and you look at a person who doesn't think they're being observed. Their eyes are glazed over.
Yeah.
Their shoulders are slumped. The hair is like they just look lifeless, and they have this glazed look, thousand yards stare on their face. And you walk. I mean, I walk up to somebody I happen to know them, and I say, "Hey, girl, how you doing?" And she goes, "Oh, fine. How are you? Hi. Hey, Miss Kate, how you doing?" And they will come back to life, but unobserved when they think they're not being observed, people just have this glazed look on their face. And when Sean, all right, what is his name? Sean, my best friend. What's down here?
Happens to me.
But you talk about what happens to the children there. I've got some comprehension of it, and I don't mean to take away from the immediate topic, but we have children in southern West Virginia.
I've seen them in West Virginia.
Who go to sleep with their clothes on at night when it rains at night.
Mm-hmm.
Because they want to make sure that if the sludge dam breaks and the billions of gallons of toxic mm-hmm. goo goes roaring down the valley, that at least they're not found naked.
Right, mm-hmm. right, right.
So we're
seeing this happening all over the country.
And I've got to imagine that something like that is happening down there. I mean, I don't know what happened. Either one of you, just chime right in. Under these circumstances, there's no such thing as childhood, is there?
No.
Oh, hell no.
You are absolutely robbed of your childhood.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely mm-hmm. robbed when something like mm-hmm. this happens to you. And when you do not have any caregiver. Now, you know, and a caregiver can not only come in the form of a parent or grandparent. It can be in a teacher. It can be in a caseworker. It can be just someone. You know, a neighbor that can intervene and give you some normalcy in your life. Children need normalcy.
Yeah.
They need some kind of routine.
A little bit of structure.
Some safety.
Yeah, a little bit of, you know, a day, one, there's got to be some sense that one day looks like the next.
Yeah, mm-hmm. constantly. Can I just, you know, it's interesting. Jim gave me these statistics, and stop me if you've already heard them.
No, go right ahead.
I don't want to take up more of the program than.
I cut everything from the minute I brought you guys on to the end of the program for you. I mean, this is your time.
Oh, thank you.
And I wish people would. If anybody's got any questions of things that we're not covering, I guess I would say this. Feel free to call in.
Oh yeah, sure. I get involved in conversations and I forget, but yeah.
And please forward them along to me. I'll be happy to answer any questions anyone has. But I just think that this is really interesting insofar as children are concerned. Jim gave me these talking points last April when I saw him. And these come right from data listed below is especially troubling since we continue to have more than 25,000 FEMA trailers in the Mississippi Gulf Coast 18 months after the storm. A, more than 50% of the respondents met the criteria for some type of major depressive disorder. If you're talking 50% based on what we talked about testing, it's got to be way higher than that.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
B, domestic violence among internally displaced residents was nearly triple the national average.
Mm-hmm.
Three times as many parents reported difficulties getting their children to school. That's another issue you just addressed. Suicide reports were reported 79 times greater than previous reports. 79% of adults with acute illnesses cited financial difficulties as the main obstacle in obtaining treatment. Mortality rates have nearly tripled
among households in trailer parks compared with pre-Katrina averages. Reported rape rates were 54 times greater than pre-Katrina levels. Those are just some bullet points.
See, this is what drives me crazy, Ann, because if you tune in to, you know, some program somewhere, you know, you're not, one, you will not hear a single Katrina-related story or about the Gulf Coast or about the Lower Ninth Ward or, you know, any portion or part of it.
Mm-hmm.
What you're going to hear is the American consumer is wary that a recession might be on the way. You know what? It ain't no recession down there. It is a full-blown depression.
Right. And it is also, the recession is also here. And it only, it's just not affecting the upper 1% of our population. I can tell you that.
No, but what's gonna happen on the Gulf Coast is that, well, it's what I said earlier talking with Jim. There's knocked down, kicked in the ribs, and then there's the boot on the throat.
Right.
Right now, I mean, the boot is on the throat, and I don't know what comes after.
People will die, Bob. Then their land will be taken back by carpetbaggers, that we used to call them after the Civil War.
Uh-huh.
And then it will be developed, and the rich will get richer, and the poor will become displaced. And here in Chicago, I remember after the Vietnam War, we began to see soldiers perhaps 4 or 5 years on the streets in Chicago. I worked downtown a few days a week at the Exchange. I'm telling you, we are seeing Iraq vets on the streets in Chicago now. I look at these things in tandem.
Sure. Well, because it all works together. I mean, I remember seeing some stories when the storm was hitting, and it was in the American consciousness about some troops who were serving in Iraq saying, you know, Jesus, get me home to help my people.
Let me help my family. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And again, but not necessarily my family. Let me help my people.
Anybody. Yeah. Right? Yeah. You're right.
I'm being asked in the chat room, Kate, and either one of you, are there any sort of ombudsman down there who will address issues for the people? I mean, or is this just completely, hey, you're on your own, here's an apple and a roadmap?
Katie,
that's
for you.
Go ahead, Ann. Go ahead.
Katie, I don't know. That would be for you.
Okay, I that's what I was talking about earlier. I haven't been here long enough to get out on the street to get a sense of the drumbeat and who's moving and shaking and who's pissing off Jackson and Washington, D.C. I don't know. I'm hoping that I'll find somebody.
But what does it look like when you pick up the local paper in the morning?
I don't even pick up the paper.
I mean, but the reason I ask is because I'd be willing to bet that you pick up the local paper, the Pascagoula Times or, you know, whatever, and you find, you know, it looks like a normal day in normal America, and you turn to the sports section and it's 19 column inches about what Ole Miss did to Coach Orgeron.
No, actually, there's a lot of recovery coverage, and there's a lot of increase in crime, obviously. But I'm boarding and rooming and boarding, I walk from my little studio to the community kitchen living room area, and I have to walk past the TV, and I'll stop in the doorway and stop and look, and they do. I didn't check this out, but I venture to say that they probably cover some kind of a storm story on WLOX out of New Orleans every broadcast, and so it's not like it's buried down here that people are just ignoring it. No, there's a big concerted effort around the community, and when are we getting the grants? When are we getting that?
Has there been a march on Jackson yet or anything?
No. We did use a box down here. It was the ballot box, and they reelected Haley Barbour.
Yeah, unfortunately.
So, you know, the box works just fine, if you like the status quo.
Well, Haley Barbour gets to be senator soon.
Well, frankly, I could have thrown up when I heard Trent Watt resigned, because his poor people of Mississippi need him so much more.
Well, but some of the background stuff, you know, the law firm that he had a tangential contact with, where the plaintiff's lawyer, who was appear, you know, at least in my book, was at least on its face, he was doing the work of the angels, suing State Farm for people who actually had coverage, who'd been screwed by their insurance company, and then the guy gets indicted because he's trying to bribe a judge to shake down a fee.
Yeah.
You know, so what's going to happen to those people?
I don't
so
know.
So thank you to whoever asked that question. That's something I've been kind of unconsciously pursuing, but now that it's out in the front of my brain, I'm going to make a concerted effort to find out who's the movers and shakers in the 3-county area that I work in, and the 5 counties that we cover. But I'm most familiar with the 3 right
now. Well, I guess I would just have a fit if I were to get down there and find out that the spring cotillion was going to go off just as planned. But it probably does, doesn't it?
Well, it does. Yeah.
Sure.
Yes, and in defense of the Mardi Gras, whoever the fool was that said, well, things are just fine here. Well, in a way, well, the quarter was that you could don't look like anything even happened when over in the quarter. But there was so much contention, arguing and fuss and then contention about whether or not to have the Mardi Gras. Well, that's part of the culture. And I can tell you, my New Orleans is gone. I haven't even been over there. I don't want to see it. I've got enough grieving to do over here with just the people I love and know. But to go back to what I knew of New Orleans, I just don't want to go there. So, but anyway, the Mardi Gras is the music. I grieve for the loss of the musicians who the musician who lost all of his pianos, the blind musician who lost all of his pianos and all of his music, just gone. I was sitting waiting for my partner the other day at Lowe's parking lot, and I was driving her car, and I popped in a tape, and it was Aaron Neville, and I thought, I just need to sit here and meditate and say thank you. At least he's alive, and he's out there. He's raising hell. Oh, God. He's the first person I ever heard say, it's just a friggin' crime scene here, and they cut him off.
Well, and, you know, I mean, it goes back to Kanye West on Saturday Night Live when he said George Bush don't care about no black people.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you know what?
Right.
He was right.
Yeah.
He's absolutely
right. You know, Bob, being up in West Virginia, I think it might be interesting. I'm going to try to, I don't know how successful I will be, but I am going to try to contact Bobby Kennedy Jr. and Mike Piafentonio.
Oh, they're well aware of us.
Are they then?
Yeah, they just completed a very successful lawsuit against the DuPont Corporation for poisoning an entire region of a county. I had the extreme good pleasure of getting to meet and chat with Mr. Kennedy for a bit when he came to visit down in the Coal River Valley area and address questions of mountaintop removal. And you know, it was so energizing for us to hear him when he said, "Look, you gotta quit acting like these are just people with whom you have a dispute. The people who are leveling your mountains are perpetrating criminal acts.
Absolutely.
They are
Absolutely.
Criminals, and until you treat them like criminals, they are going to continue their criminal conduct."
Right. I agree, and that's a whole part of that is a whole basis of what. My
but don't hesitate to contact them. I mean, tell them, yeah, please,
yeah,
please.
Yeah.
We need all
because
the advocacy we can get.
Right. I don't look at that any differently than I do the destruction that's going on down in the Mississippi Gulf region, et cetera, et cetera. And in various other places throughout the United States that we don't even know about.
Oh,
yet.
Kate, I sent you an email a couple of days ago that was sent to me through the email network about an absolute horror story in Arizona.
Yes, yes, and I didn't get to it because my desk got buried, and I wanted to sit and just.
But it's another coal story.
It's very much. Yeah, I gave it a cursory glance, and I want to get back to it, but I don't have a computer out here, so I have to do it at the office when nobody's there.
Well, it'll blow your mind when you see it. I mean, and that's what. I don't know. Maybe part of building that sense of shared community, comes from the realization of it can happen here.
Correct. I actually had a Chicago police officer whom I used to live next door to, who is a detective before I moved, who looked at me, and he was watering his lawn one July evening, and I was talking to him, and he looked at me and he said, "Annie, I'm telling you something. If anyone that you know what hits the fan, you're on your own." And so, Bob, directly in line with what you were saying, you know, you have to stop looking at these people like they are in positions of power. We have to start looking at them as, no, you put your pants on one leg at a time the way I do, and you're a crook.
Yep.
If you've done this, you're a crook. Mm-hmm. If you have taken from
Absolutely.
The least amongst us, you are a criminal.
And, the other side of it is that the more we say that kind of thing, the more nervous the crooks are going to get.
Well, I'm sorry. Yeah.
And
it's about time to get nervous.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It absolutely is. I think about the water. You know, I had great fun on the air with Georgia Governor Sonny Perdue moving his public prayer for rain until he found a day when the weatherman said he thought it was going to drizzle a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What a coup, hey?
Yeah, but the thing is, you would think that people would learn.
I know.
You know, you're in Chicago. I mean, I don't have to tell you, Ann. You're in one of the most fragile places in America.
Oh, I know.
And that's not because it's Chicago. That's because it's a huge metropolitan city. If you come here to West Virginia and you talk to some of the good old boys that are hunters, they'll start talking to you about things like carrying capacity.
Oh.
and then you look at them and you go, what do you reckon the capacity is of Manhattan Island? And they'll go, hell of a lot less than it's got on it.
Yep.
Because we are, and that's the dynamic tension, I guess, of the rise of human civilization, is the ability to create artificial carrying capacity. But when Atlanta can't, never mind watering the lawn, when Atlanta can't get a drink of water when it wants it.
That's right. And they're talking about taking water from the Great Lakes now.
Yeah.
Dominating this, you know.
Well, Sonny Perdue wants to put a pipe in the Tennessee River.
I say, yep. Leave that Tennessee River alone.
And
yeah,
I know a lot of people get right tetchy about having the Tennessee River drained.
Is David one of them? Is he listening?
Yeah, he's among them. People where I grew up get a little upset at the idea too, because they're not real fond of Georgians in the first place. But that's another part of it. It's this. You're not one of us. By God,
well,
we're all
County,
one of us.
Well, the Collar counties around here feel the same way about Chicago. They feel like Chicago should be its own state, the rest of the state, and Illinois should be its own state.
Oh, I remember the legislator somewhere in the Confederate Congress at the time of the Civil War, who wanted to launch a plan to dig a big ditch around Massachusetts and float it out to sea.
Oh, yeah. Well, in Illinois was split in the Civil War. And I actually had, I was in England a year and a half ago, say, and I had a Greek Cypriot actually say to me in a sandwich shop in London, you know, you people don't know it, but you've just never stopped fighting the Civil War.
Oh, we haven't. I mean, I
was just floored.
I was born and raised in Alabama, and I can tell you, Ann.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-mm. No, my second grade teacher referred to it as the War of Northern Aggression.
Yep. I was stupefied to hear that. Just stupefied.
Those little troubles back in the day. Yeah.
The recent unpleasantness.
The recent unpleasantness. I wanted to.
We're talking about, I'm hoping that there's somebody out in the audience who's thinking, well, but what can I do?
Yeah,
and me too.
I want to say, just go on a Google volunteer Mississippi Gulf Coast, or just do a search, and you'll find all kinds of volunteer centers. You'll find all kinds of opportunities to come down here and volunteer, particularly from what my personal knowledge is that you can come to Jackson County. There are many, many churches who have set up dorms. There's a big volunteer center over in Ocean Springs where you pay to stay there, but that's for, I think they have a community kitchen and they have to paid staff to keep the place running and that sort of thing. And there's a kitchen in a church here in Pascagoula who has an industrial kitchen, and if there's
plenty of volunteers here, they'll feed them. If they know that you're going to have 15 volunteers for a week, they'll feed you for $6 a day. And so there's plenty of nice motels out on the highway, and I don't know what the rates are. Ann could be better to tell you that. But you can even get tax deduction if you're business, if you're coming down here to volunteer. It doesn't take a lot of skill. Wayne and I talked about this the other night. You talked about the fireman teaching the person how to, or the two before with the kid, and you can come down here, and if you're skilled, you can teach or guide some youth or some people who are already down here, like college kids. They need help with learning how to sheetrock or something. There's plenty to do, and not to worry about work orders, because if you needed to, I can turn you on to 15 jobs right now. You put you to work in the morning. There's plenty to do. You don't have to get dirty particularly. We're not necessarily mucking out houses anymore. It's just finishing up the grandma's bedroom. It just needs more sheetrock and then painting. That's all. Right. It's just there's so many things to do.
And also, to add to that too, those are so necessary. But also just people who will go and listen.
That's where I was going, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
And be a witness. And listen to, I found when I was doing my filming and my taping, I would compartmentalize the story into what was your life like before, during, and after. And allow the people to tell their stories, allow them to tell what happened to them. And it has such a wonderful effect on them that someone even cared to come. It's cathartic that they would care and come and listen.
I hear all these. I hear all these things, and it drives me personally batty. And I'm not. That's not a criticism. I feel like that I ought to be there. That I ought to.
Oh, I leave, and I'm in tears. I wish I had more money. I wish I had more stature. I wish I had more resources. I wish I had more time. There is never a time that I'm back in Chicago that a piece of me isn't with the people in Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
Never. But, but you do what you can as you can. And, Bob, you know what? And I've said this to Mike Malloy, too.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know how much good you're doing just providing a venue to get this information.
I understand that. I truly do, but it doesn't change in my heart the urge to.
Your heart is changed.
To give of myself and to be able. I mean, hell, if I could figure out some way to do it, I'd pack up the little mobile studio, and. Go down, as long as I got a broadband connection, I can broadcast from down there.
You betcha.
I'd love to figure out a way to do that.
Well,
I think it needs to be seen, and until I've seen it, I'm sort of operating in the dark.
I've got tapes.
I'd love to view the man. I truly would.
I would love to share them with you.
But I'd love also, and this is honest to Pete, I would.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to go down there. I'd love to set up somewhere in a public area,
mm-hmm.
and for 3 hours a night, just say, look, nobody else is doing this. Come here and tell me your story. Tell thousands of Americans over this country, over this world, your story. And if you say booger, nobody's going to flip out because the right-wing FCC is going to hang a fine on me. This is the internet.
Exactly.
We're free. You say what you need to say.
Right.
There was a public meeting not long ago, and they had people come in from one woman was being case managed by United Way, or she was a worker there or something. Another guy was from someplace else, and he was a client or a consumer of whatever he was getting. He had a case manager, and they one guy was blind, and he was the star of the show, and they all talked. They were just darlings, and the one lady said, Well, she's pretty brash and harsh, and she says, well, after she finished, she says, I can tell you this much, I ain't going to vote for Haley Barbour. And the woman, the director of the United Way got fired.
Got fired?
Uh-huh. Wow. Them boys are everywhere, and it's just pretty dangerous. But anyway, you know, speaking of public, I logged on to YouTube today to get the address off of it because I needed to email it to somebody. And there were only, this was today, and that YouTube went out Monday. We got it from that staff meeting. There were only 1,021 hits on that YouTube.
Well, we need to put that up on the blog.
And I had about 25 or 50, 20, 35, 20, well, probably 25 just in my own email box.
Wow.
And there's only 1,021 hits. However, this is my good news. The first response, I've only gotten one response personally to that video, and it was from my friend, my 16-year-old friend in Poznan, Poland.
Oh, wow.
I got the email from Tomas, and he said, I can't believe that people don't have their homes. This is incredible. What is your residence address so I can donate? And I cried. His daddy is my very, very best friend, but Tomas is now 16. He's not 5 anymore. And he's the response. Imagine that. He's the response that I got to that YouTube. But there's only 1,021 hits on that, too. I said, what do you... You get the email and you don't look at the YouTube after I said this little, sweet little thing, you know, about we need a dollar. Like we need $5 and $10 bills to the horn, we just need a dollar. That ain't no big deal.
Yeah.
It
turns out I just had a message from John Fox, and let me tell folks that he's got a computer crisis he has to go into Sydney and deal with as part of his real job. So there's not going to be any live John Fox. There's not going to be any live Peter Godbold. So
go home and go to bed.
I'm gonna mail in the horn section too, because it's meant to be a collaboration. It's not meant to be a solo. So I'm gonna do that, since I'm gonna have a little bit of downtime afterward, Kate, I'm gonna look at moving that video around a little bit.
Okay. Well, I just we just need $1 to finish the job. That's all.
Let me ask a question though, Kate. It was put to me in the chat room. Is Habitat for Humanity active down there?
Yes, actually, she was one of the reps that was at the meeting, and they have a lot of 9 homes. They've got money to start up 9 homes in Pascagoula this coming. I saw somebody out taking measurements while ago, Sunday from Habitat. So yeah, they're working. Uh-huh.
And just to sort of tie everything together, because we are running out of time, a little bit of breaking news that's just been handed to us by our good friend Lottie in the chat room. And this
Lottie, hi.
Yeah. Say it louder, Kate.
Hello. I missed you. If I had a computer down here in the Netherlands.
To show that everything is Katrina in many ways. A report out, 6 school children have been shot after getting off a bus in Las Vegas, 2 of them in critical condition. Local police officer says he believed the shots were fired just before 2 p.m. Nevada time. The 6 children have been taken to local hospitals, where 4 are being treated for minor gunshot wounds and 2 are in critical condition. Police unsure of the age of the students, but believe they're from a junior high or a high school.
You know, Bob, I really believe that the collective, the more and more as this intensifies, and we've seen it building for at least the last 8 years, if not 10, you know, I believe that the collective itself is just getting more and more hinky. Good old police term for you. More and more hinky. I think the collective is just starting to get, people are getting so frazzled and so frayed and just beyond themselves. They don't know what to do. The fear factor is just off the charts. And so I think that you're seeing this coming out in the most... who ever heard when we were kids, you know, mothers killing their kids in bathtubs, children shooting other children, you know, you just never heard these types of, I'm not saying it didn't go on, all right, but it was never at the rate and intensity that we're experiencing it now. And I think that it goes beyond the fact that our technology is better. I think that there is something just happening to people.
Well, consider that the entire nation in the 19th century was literally moved for decades to the point of a nursery rhyme being made out of it by Lizzie Borden.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, got him. Yeah.
Okay, Lizzie Borden is boring now. If Lizzie Borden had lived in the 20th or 21st century in gun-crazed America, she would have gotten an AK-47, and she wouldn't have given her mother 40 whacks and her father 41. She would have given her mother a bullet, her father a bullet, and gone into the street and mowed down half of that Massachusetts, I think it was Massachusetts,
Absolutely.
Community
Absolutely.
Where she lived.
Absolutely, and she probably had the ranking of the Menendez brothers. You know?
Yeah, and immediately there would have been some member of the religion industry on the television telling us that it was because of secular humanism. Just
oh,
like
God.
Happened
of
today.
Course, of course. Okay.
So I've brought the program full circle. Kate, thank you both so very much for taking so much of your time to have this conversation. I hope it has been as pleasant and beneficial for y'all as it has for me. This show, this network, will always exist to provide a forum for issues such as this, because, well, our sort of, I guess maybe it's time we do a crest for the horn, you know, with a coat of arms and everything, and I think our Latin motto will be, if we don't do it, who will?
That's right. And underneath
that is a little reminder of parentheses, chaos is always self-correcting.
That's right.
Yeah, we'll put that in Greek, Kate.
I like that.
Everybody's shooting each other, people not showing up to volunteer to take care of the people down here, not being able to contribute the $1 bill, it's chaos. You're right, it's collective consciousness. It's
right,
just
I think
shifting.
It has something to do with the collective, and I think they're just going absolutely
right.
Hinky.
That's right.
And I can't tell you how much I appreciate having had this opportunity to speak on your show. Thank you so much.
And anytime, please, I say
really
that in all sincerity, anytime that you feel like there's something that needs to be said, Kate can tell you, we'll drop everything and listen.
Thank you.
And she's coming back in February. She's coming back down here in February, and don't you
Absolutely.
Know we're going to have another story to tell?
Oh, you bet you.
Well, both of you, again, thank you very much, and thank you, and I hope the listening audience was as moved as I was.
Thank you.
Well,
so
I do
much.
Too. This has been very important to me, and I appreciate you taking my call, Bob. And Annie,
right.
Take care.
Oh,
you
too, sweetie.
Y'all take care.
Okay,
and I hope we'll talk
you.
Again soon.
Merry
thank
Christmas
you.
And happy holidays, everybody.
Absolutely. To you too, Ann.
Thank you so
Good night.
Much.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
I'll
talk to you later.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Our good friend Kate from the Mississippi Gulf Coast and our new friend Ann Keating from Chicago, having been on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. Take that to heart. We don't do 2 hours of that because there wasn't 2 hours of something else to do. We do 2 hours of that because it is as important a pair of hours as any we have to give. Thanks, everybody. As I said, no John Fox, no horn section. Well, I mean, there'll be reruns and stuff, but the live programming ends here. Thanks to John Fox, to Peter Godbold, to Ben Birch, the hardest working man in liberal talk at WhiteRoseSociety.org. And always, 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 RMR, Gina, it's all for you. We'll be right back.
This is the Quality News Network. Al-Qaeda militants are suspected in twin car bombings in Algeria's capital city this morning. The confirmed death toll stands at 26, but is expected to rise much higher in one of the bloodiest civil attacks in recent North African history. Al-Qaeda's North African cell has taken responsibility for the blasts on an Islamist internet website. Five United Nations workers were killed, and the UN's High Commissioner says that the UN was the intended target for assassination. The Federal Reserve cut a key interest rate by 0.25 percentage point to 4.25%. It is the third rate cut in 3 months. The prime lending rate now standing down to 7.25%, the lowest level in 2 years. CIA Director Michael Hayden's testimony on Capitol Hill today left some questions unanswered. Democrats want to know who authorized the destruction of interrogation tapes made in 2002 and why Congress was not told about it. Meantime, a former CIA interrogator told lawmakers that the interrogation technique called waterboarding saved lives in the war against Al-Qaeda, but is torture and should not be used, saying, quote, "Americans are better than that," unquote. Iraq's national security advisor says his country will never allow the U.S. to maintain permanent military bases in Iraq. Today he announced economic, political, and diplomatic support would be welcome, but Baghdad refuses a permanent military presence. Talks between Israeli and Palestinian leaders start tomorrow. It's the first formal peace negotiation in 7 years. In Beirut, Lebanon, presidential elections set for today have been postponed 1 week. Political parties are negotiating a peaceful resolution for a handover of power in Lebanon. In New Jersey, state senators have approved a plan to abolish the death penalty, a proposal already supported by New Jersey's assembly and governor. It would be the first state in the nation to ban executions in 40 years. There are 8 prisoners currently on New Jersey's death row. And the nation's midsection belted with snow and ice today. Widespread power outages reported, roads and airports shut down. At least 17 deaths are being blamed strictly on the weather. You're listening to the Quality News Network. We'll take a look at business news right after this.
Living our lives in a civil fashion is a declaration of intent. It says we are ready to put our better selves forward for the well-being of the community. It's like romance. When you fall in love, you are on your best behavior. The delight in making a loving connection with someone brings out the best in us, naturally. It is natural to acknowledge our fellow human beings with a nod of the head or a smile, to show them the respect we would want them to show us. The more we are civil, with strangers and with those who already know us, the healthier a spirit we create for ourselves, for each other, and the surrounding community. George Washington, the founder of a great nation, declared, "Every action done in company ought to be with some sign of respect to those that are present." Civility is essential to community health. For more information, click on the Civility button on our website, qualitynewsnetwork.com.
NASA researchers say they may have discovered the source of energy for the mysterious northern lights. A current of charged particles from the sun, twisted through a magnetic field, produces energy released in a spectacular display of color across the far northern hemisphere. In a check of business news, Bank of America is dissolving its Columbia cash portfolio for institutional investors, liquidating $22 billion in assets during the past 2 weeks. B of A cites losses related to the subprime mortgage crisis.